Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
A group of musicians is rehearsing in a small town not far from the Pacific coast of southern Mexico in the state of Oaxaca. This music is known as the Dance of the Devils. It's late October and they're getting ready to play at the Day of the Dead festivities when they honor their ancestors. I'm Lucy Duran and welcome to The Documentary here on the BBC World Service. I'm here to take part in a series of music workshops to encourage young children in towns like this to learn more about their musical heritage. And that heritage is Afro-Mexican. Who are these Afro-Mexicans? I barely knew of their existence before coming to Oaxaca, and it seems I'm not the only one. In this country, made up mostly of people of Spanish or indigenous origin, many don't seem to realize that there's also a substantial group of people who call themselves black. In this program, we'll be talking to Afro-Mexicans about their history and their way of life. We'll find out how they feel marginalized and ignored by their fellow countrymen and are often mistaken for foreigners. And we'll learn about a growing movement to get better recognition for Afro-Mexicans at national level. Music is at the heart of Afro-Mexican identity here in Oaxaca, and this tune is especially important. It's played on the unlikely combination of a harmonica, a mule's jawbone, and a drum with a stick that's rubbed. Even small children know the steps of the Dance of the Devils. My journey begins in a small town called José María Morelos, where I stop off at the local primary school.
What's your name?
Annette.
How old are you, Annette?
Siete.
She's 7 years old. Are you going to dance the Dance of the Devils? Yes?
Porque me gusta.
Ah, because she likes it.
Me gusta bailar.
Ah, ¿tú sabes el paso?
Sí.
A ver. I'm asking her if she knows the step of the Dance of the Devils. And she says she does. Adelante. Yeah, excellent. Very good. The name of the teacher is Angustia Reyes. What the school teacher is asking her children is, when do you dance the Dance of the Devil, the Dance of the Devils? And they say, they reply, shouting, on the Day of the Dead. She says, why on the Day of the Dead? She says, because that's when the devils come. And she says, what do they bring? They bring love. So, the Dance of the Devils, these are black men. Are you black?
Sí. Negra. Soy negra.
She says, yes, she's black. Are you proud of being black?
Sí.
What does it mean to be black?
La personalidad.
Your character. So what is a black personalidad? What is a black character?
Es el mismo.
To be myself. Muy bien. That's a lovely answer. Un aplauso. She says, what other dances will we do on the Day of the Dead? They reply, the dance of the turtle and the dance of the bull. And she says, what does that identify us as? And they reply, as black.
I'm wondering why these children see themselves as black when many of them, in fact, look quite indigenous. But then, this ethnic mix isn't surprising. During Spanish colonial rule, it seems, the child of a black father and a white or indigenous woman would be born free. But where both father and mother were black, their child would be born into slavery.
La mayoría de niños, si le preguntas ahorita, te van a decir que son negros. Negros o la gente mayor.
She says that they themselves call themselves black, that the older generation would use the word moreno, which means dark, dark-skinned, but the word that they do not use at all is Afro-Mexican. That is an academic term that's been introduced from outside. It's not in local currency at all. So I have in front of me a piece of paper with a dictation that they've just done in Spanish. I'll translate it into English. It says, the Day of the Dead is celebrated on the 31st of October and the 1st and 2nd of November. It's the souls of people who are resting in peace, but who come back to enjoy fruits and sweets and the dance of the devils and of the turtle, which are part of our identity as blacks, as the blacks that we are. Parte de nuestra identidad como negros que somos. I should probably reiterate that this is a dictation given them by the teacher. So it's not something that comes from the children. And a question that I ask myself is to what extent this sense of blackness is imparted by the teachers from the top down or from outside in.
Ellos mismos, ahorita le haces una pregunta que cómo se consideran o qué, a qué grupo étnico pertenecen.
And she says that actually it's in people's homes that they call themselves black, that their mothers and fathers call themselves black, their grandparents call themselves black. So that's how they see themselves. Not just the color of the skin. But if I look at these children, many of them look much more indigenous than black to me. So what makes them black?
Porque somos negros. Creo que si sacamos o hacemos un estudio del mestizaje, no hay negros.
So she says that if one did proper research, we'd probably find out that there is no 100% black person in Mexico. They are very mixed. But they see themselves as black because of where they are located geographically. And that's how they've always grown up thinking of themselves as black.
Locals do seem to prefer the term black, but the more official word, Afro-Mexican, is also gaining ground. And the black or Afro-Mexican community is now dedicating an annual event to its culture and identity. This is the central square of a small country town called Morelos in Oaxaca, not far from the Pacific coast. There are mountains in the distance. It's very tropical. It's raining and humid. And the square is teeming with people who've come to celebrate a really special day, El Día del Pueblo Negro Afro-Mexicano de Oaxaca, the Day of the Black Afro-Mexican People of Oaxaca. All the local dignitaries are here, as is the young woman who won the Black Queen Beauty Contest. And she is truly fabulous looking in her red and white traditional dress. Interestingly enough, Morelos is named after José María Morelos, the great Mexican liberator who himself was black. So the black community have played an important role in the history of Mexico, but they're fighting for better recognition and more rights in the Constitution. And that's what today is all about. It's a celebration, but also a plea for greater awareness of who they are, of their identity, and of their rights. And here's Dalia Reyes, a stunning young woman who won the competition for Black Queen.
We as black people are part of what makes up Mexico, but the black people haven't been recognized. I feel enormously proud to be Black Queen and feel very happy.
I'm here in Oaxaca, working with a team of professional musicians and researchers from Mexico and from Mali. Our project aims to encourage young Afro-Mexicans to learn more about their own distinctive musical traditions. It's funded by the British Academy. This trip has been a voyage of discovery for me. Despite years of working in West Africa and the Caribbean, I knew next to nothing about Afro-Mexican culture before coming here. My colleague, guide, and translator is Dr. Sergio Navarrete Pellicer, who's an ethnomusicologist here in Oaxaca. All around, there are huge rolling plains lying between the mountains on one side and the Pacific on the other. It's stunning, but very remote. And it's cowboy country. Black cowboys, that is. Their ancestors were enslaved Africans who were used as foremen on the cattle ranches from the earliest days of Spanish settlement back in the 16th century. Their role as foreman is reenacted in the Dance of the Devils by the brash character Pancho. He struts around with a whip, whilst his buxom white wife, played by a man, flirts outrageously with the rest of the cowboy devils and even with the audience. There's plenty of satire and humor in this dance. Presumably, it was a way of dealing with the harsh living conditions during times of slavery. Slavery was abolished in Mexico at the time of the struggle for independence in the early 19th century. But cattle raising still goes on. I'm off to meet a real-life foreman on a cattle ranch outside a small town, Santiago Llano Grande.
The one thing that you do not get on radio are smells, and the rich smell of cows here is overwhelming, of cow and cow dung. This is an enclosure that we've come to in the middle of very, very deep countryside. There are large numbers of cows here. Their little calves are just in a separate enclosure because they're not old enough yet to eat the grass. And I can hear the horse neighing in the distance of the cowboy that we're going to be talking to, who is in charge of this herd of cattle. He's approaching us on horseback, herding in the cows. The cows have just come into this enclosure, and I'm standing here right next to them. They have quite pointy horns, so I'm hoping to stay away from them. There's a big bull, big black bull, huge black bull, actually. I think I'm just going to move a little bit away. Most of them are female cows, and I think they're going to be milked. Let's go over and watch the milking. That's the sound of the milk being squeezed out of the udders of the cow. Right next to the cow is her calf, so that she produces milk. You can hear the milk squirting into the pail. And this is the cowboy that's herded them in, who's doing the milking, Antonio Prudente López. Antonio, mucho gusto. Buenos días. Buenos Soy días. Lucy Duran, de la BBC. ¿Cómo está usted? How are you?
Bien, bien.
What's life like for you as a cowboy? Is it really tough? Do you spend long, long hours on horseback?
Pues aquí es de vinial ordeña.
He says that that's his work, that he goes and brings the cows every morning and milks the cows, and he's also supervising during the day, fixing the fences and doing that sort of thing.
When did you learn to do this?
Pues yo ya tengo como 25 años porque de
He's been doing this for 25 years. His father did the same, and so he learned all the skills from his father, who also worked here for the owner of the land.
Pues el vaquero de su sueño pues también
He likes to be a cowboy, to be riding the horses, to carry his machete, which is a kind of a sword to cut the grass and to fix fences and to cut branches for different purposes, and that is what he likes to do.
So how important is the cowboy in your town? How many people of Llano Grande of your age are vaqueros, for example, or cowboys?
La verdad, andas unos 100.
Between 100 and 200, he estimates. 10% of the population work as cowboys.
Antonio, how do you describe yourself? Do you consider yourself black? Do you consider yourself Afro-Mexicano?
Yo sí, negro, y estoy orgulloso de mi color, la verdad.
He says definitely yes, I'm very proud of being black. They use different names for that. That could be moreno, black, prieto, which are different ways of saying black. And that's the way they use those words for referring to each other.
Antonio, I've heard that the life of the vaquero, of the cowboy, is very much associated with black identity, with being black in the Costa Chica. Is this true?
Aquí es lo más bonito para uno de aquí de la Costa Chica todo.
So he says that yes, that's what the people do here on the coast. That's a lot of fun, since when they are very, very young, like 2-3 years old, they start riding. So that's a way of life that they like, they enjoy.
So, black people have been in this region for hundreds of years, and yet their existence is so little known that they're often treated as foreigners. Clemente Jesus Lopez is head of the government office in charge of Afro-Mexicans in Oaxaca.
Nosotros hemos recibido varios casos y atendido varios casos de personas que...
We have dealt with cases of people who were detained by the federal police, were asked for their ID, and produced their federal ID, like these two women. One was deported to Honduras and the other to Haiti, because the police insisted that in Mexico there are no black people. So, despite having Mexican ID, they were deported. They are now back, but had to deal with the consulates in those countries to negotiate their return. And the police offered no apology, let alone compensation. Just an, oh, it was a mistake.
It's not racism.
I mean, why should Alex Haley be the only person to discover their roots, you know?
I'm sorry, Alex what?
You know, Alex Haley. Roots.
Roots? What is that, some kind of gardening show?
You're joking, right? Roots. You know, roots.
I don't follow you.
Roots. 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 You've never heard of Roots? The miniseries? Come here, honey. Hold on. Here. Roots.
I don't know nothing about what you're talking about.
Almost 25 years after his death, there's now a biography on the writer Alex Haley. Alex Haley has written two of the most consequential books in America in the 20th century. The autobiography of Malcolm X as told to Alex Haley, and Roots, which would be turned into a television miniseries and help change the national discourse on slavery. The author of the biography is Robert J. Norell. The biography is called Alex Haley and the Books That Changed a Nation. Robert J. Norell is also a professor of history at the University of Tennessee. He joins us over Skype from North Carolina. Robert J. Norell, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thank you very much for having me.
The story of Alex Haley is a fascinating one, and especially when you look at his first 40 years of life. You may not automatically see that this is a man who would end up helping write Malcolm X's autobiography or even Roots.
Well, yes, that's correct. I mean, he came from a fairly comfortable black family in Tennessee. His father was a college professor. His mother had a college education. His grandfather had been one of the wealthiest men in this little town of Henning, Tennessee. And Alex grew up in a circumstance in Henning and in other places, college towns that he lived, with some insulation from the harsh racial realities that perhaps the average black person felt during that time, the 1920s and 1930s.
Is it in the Coast Guard where he begins to write?
It is. Haley was, I think, always a good writer. You know, sort of naturally, he was an avid reader, especially of adventure stories as a child. And you know, often the person who reads extensively has a natural flair for writing, and he did that. When he got in the Coast Guard, he went in, of course, as a messman, as a cook, which was the only job given to blacks in the Coast Guard at that time, as a menial job, really, a servant's job. And he took that work with some equanimity, but one of his fellow, really his boss in the galley on the ships, realized that Alex wrote a lot of letters. He brought on the ship with him a little portable typewriter, and he would write a lot of letters. And his boss looked at him askance at that, but then finally realized that Alex's talent could be put to his boss, Percival. And they ultimately developed first a kind of morale-building thing where Alex wrote letters and put out a newspaper for the ship. And then he developed a business where he would write love letters for his shipmates to, you know, girls afar. Alex would write the letter or type up a letter for them, and then they would copy it for a dollar a shot. And this became really his vocation. When he was in the Coast Guard, and that was then parlayed into doing publicity and public relations until finally, after World War II, he was named chief journalist of the Coast Guard.
He was in the Coast Guard, as you mentioned, during the World War II era. This is when the military begins to desegregate. At one point, he wanted to make a career out of this, didn't he?
Well, he did make a career of 20 years. And he did, in a sense, a rise in the Coast Guard at a time when the racial barriers, which had been severe, completely closed, were opportunities for African Americans. But they began to open up a little during the war and then more after the war. President Truman's 1948 order to desegregate the armed forces. And Alex was in a position to benefit from that. And because he was a talented and extremely likable guy, he did well as a Coast Guard public relations man, first in New York and then in San Francisco.
I was a little surprised to learn that this is the first biography on Alex Haley here almost 25 years after his death.
Yeah, I don't really know how to explain that. There was another very brief and simplistic biography. But mine, I think, is the first one that's based heavily on the manuscript collections of Haley and others. I think some of that had to do with the fact that soon after Haley died, there was a profile of him that appeared in the Village Voice that was extremely critical of Haley and really a kind of exercise in name-calling, saying that, in fact, he was a fraud. That may have steered people, you know, away from writing about him. There was a pretty strong sentiment in the academic world that Haley's claims that Roots was a work of nonfiction was false, and thus perhaps he had not been worthy of the celebrity that he did enjoy in his life. And that may have been why hadn't been done. There was a person who was going to write a biography and work with Haley during the last years of Haley's life, but she Haley died in early 92, but she herself, her name is Anne Romaine, died in 1995 very suddenly. So that would have been, I think, the first biography. But then there was no one else took it on.
Tell me more about his book, Roots, what he meant it to be, and then the controversy around it.
Well, even while he was struggling to finish the autobiography of Malcolm X, he became really engaged, sort of consumed by unraveling his family's history.
And do you think that's because of his relationship to Malcolm X?
Well, I never quite figured that out. I think because he was doing the thing simultaneously, or starting the research at the same time he was finishing Malcolm X, there had to be connections. And of course, Malcolm's engagement with Africa and black nationalist issues surely must have provoked Haley to some extent to want to know about his own family's African past. He never explicitly made that connection, but he certainly was committed to understanding the African past while he was still trying to finish up Malcolm X. And the point, I think, was for him, and I think he figured this was going to be a real selling point for the book. He'd be the first African-American to unlock the mystery of slavery and black family origins. And it was a great idea, and that's what he saw Roots as, to track his own genealogy back into Africa. And, you know, he set out to do it. It took him 12 years.
And hit the book, along with the ABC mini television series that would come after based on the book, tell me the influence that had on the public discourse in this country about slavery.
Roots came at an opportune moment. Americans had just been through a long period of reevaluating the place of black people in America during the Civil Rights Movement. And the Civil Rights Movement, you know, was a time of turmoil in the 1960s that really ended up with a great rehabilitation, reform of American race relations. And in the aftermath of that, there was a lot of call to rethink the earlier history of black people in America. There had been, through the 1960s and well into the 1970s, a great revision of Americans' understanding, or at least academic understanding, of slavery. Great many important books published in the late 60s, early 70s about American slavery, and essentially challenging the older view, that American slavery had been a sort of benign institution where blacks were property, but were treated in relatively well. And then the writing in the 1960s and 70s really turned that on its ear. But all that was in the universities, in the academy. The public's mind was still, I think, more nearly shaped about slavery from things like Gone with the Wind. So Haley comes along with this big popular book, clearly aimed at the general public, that tells a story about slavery with all kinds of vivid characters from his own family. And it was the absolute right moment for the public to start thinking differently about American slavery and the black family in America. And then, of course, Hollywood took it up and made 8-night miniseries. This was one of the first miniseries, and it was the first one really done that where it was run night after night. And, you know, it captured the whole nation's attention in January and early February of 1977. 135 million people saw all or part of Roots. And, of course, the power of television was transformative about what people in America thought about.
So yeah, how long until the controversy then followed?
Well, yeah, it was almost immediate. The miniseries ran, as I said, in the first weeks of 1977. In April of 1977, there was a long article in the London Times saying that Haley had essentially made up his African ancestors. Kunta Kinte just essentially created him. It was fictional. There was some academic support or an examination by a historian and anthropologist who said, yeah, that's essentially right, pointing out all the flaws in his research. And then some other academic genealogists track through Haley's tracing of his family in the United States, back through Virginia and North Carolina. That fed into this kind of rising doubt about whether Roots was indeed nonfiction. For the average person, I don't think it mattered that much. It was a great story. People believed it was representational of the past. And, you know, after all, Americans thinking about race and especially slavery had been shaped mostly by fictional works like Gone with the Wind, and before that, Birth of a Nation, and before that, Uncle Tom's Cabin. So it was okay, but it was a mistake for Haley and his publisher to have made the claim of nonfiction. In fact, and Haley didn't help matters by saying his was a work of faction, you know, a neologism that I think just kind of fueled criticism. So the criticism pretty much, you know, settled down through the 1980s. But Haley's, his celebrity was dimmed some. He continued to work, and especially to work with Hollywood. They produced a second Roots series, sort of Roots the Next Generation, that was a big success in Hollywood. He worked with Norman Lear on a series about a southern town in the 1930s that was really closely adapted from Haley's own experience as a child.
The criticism and the focus on the criticism sounds today kind of like missing the forest for the trees.
Well, you know, that's why I wrote the book. I do believe that the criticism of Haley and the questions about whether Roots was fact or fiction did somehow miss grappling with or at least acknowledging the great significance that it had on changing how Americans thought about slavery and race and the black family, all of which, of course, had been, you know, very much an issue during the civil rights period in the 1960s. And then we had this kind of riveting story. It helps African-Americans understand perhaps the shape of their own past, and it helps white Americans understand that black people indeed did have a remarkable and sometimes heroic experience in slavery. It helped Americans in general to own the past. It provoked lots of people to go in quest of their own genealogy, their own family background. The fact of that is still with us. So all of those things, I think, were really important developments in our culture for which Haley was responsible and should be credited. But he'd sort of, and it seems to me, almost been swept under the rug because of this very harsh treatment that he got from this New York journalist in the Village Voice. And then, that influenced how the academic world, at least, treated Haley and Roots, to the extent that I think that there was a willingness to ignore it.
One of the stories that helped put him on the map was his interview with Miles Davis. And you quote Alex Haley in his approach towards interviewing as this. I'm going to quote it, and this is Alex Haley talking. "I like to study the person, study what they've done, be low-key in my approach with them, project by my manner and my sincerity, which really has to be sincere, that I was genuinely interested in what they did and how they did it." Tell me about his interview with Miles Davis. And this comes during a time when Miles Davis would not do interviews with white reporters.
Yeah, Miles Davis was a really interesting guy. He was a guy who was not only an extremely talented jazz musician, but he had come up in a world that, kind of like Haley, in the sense that he was sort of privileged, And he was very sure of himself. So sure of himself that, you know, if people weren't polite to him in a club, you know, he would he would chew them out, cuss them out. And he was very sensitive to racial slights at a time when other black celebrities like Louis Armstrong and Sammy Davis Jr. had a very strong inclination to ignore any slight, not Miles Davis. And so he was successful. He didn't think he had to, you know, to make too much accommodation with journalists and essentially dismiss them. But he liked Alex. And Alex, you know, even went so far as to go to Miles Davis's gym where he boxed for exercise and got in the ring with Miles Davis. Miles Davis, and got pretty well beat up apparently, and that endeared Haley to Miles Davis. And then, of course, Haley let Miles Davis really have his say about the indignities that a black musician had to endure, even one as celebrated as he was. All that went into Playboy, and Haley was viewed as someone, if you were going to be the subject of an interview, he was viewed as someone who would listen to your side of it and get the harsh as well as the sweet in the published page of Playboy. So that was extremely important. That was the first one, and that then led to Malcolm X. The interview was Malcolm X, which then led to the book.
And again, with Malcolm X, it's first an interview that's published by Playboy. This is when Playboy is just beginning to do journalism, serious journalism.
Well, yeah, you know, Playboy, Haley gets connected to him, 61 or 62. The Playboy company had a kind of celebrity, entertainment celebrity magazine that failed. And Haley was trying to write for them. That went under. He had done this big interview with Miles Davis, and they just shifted it to Playboy and made that then the Miles Davis interview as the model for other ones. And, you know, Playboy had been, coming into existence in the mid-50s as a girly magazine, and was a very successful high end, you know, slick paper girly magazine. But Hugh Hefner and some other people working for him believed that there was an opportunity to sort of marry the pictures of women to the important social issues, and because they were, you know, kind of trying to promote a sort of liberal sexual mores, they became quite liberal. They were quite liberal in their political and social viewpoint.
Hugh Hefner was a supporter of civil rights.
That's right. And the magazine was very out front in reporting on and supporting the civil rights movement. And so it was natural then that they went from Miles Davis to Malcolm X to Cassius Clay, soon to be Muhammad Ali, to Martin Luther King, in one interview after another that Haley conducted.
Now, when Alex Haley begins to work with Malcolm X on the autobiography of Malcolm X, this is a period when Malcolm X is still within the Nation of Islam. And much of the story about Malcolm X having taking the Hajj to Mecca, leaving the Nation of Islam, the controversy, and then obviously his assassination, this all happens during the period in which Alex Haley and Malcolm X are working on the autobiography. The way that Alex Haley got this opportunity was that he met with Elijah Muhammad, the prophet with the Nation of Islam. What do we know about his meeting with Elijah Muhammad?
Well, when Alex approached Malcolm about doing an autobiography, Malcolm said, well, you'll have to get the approval of the prophet. You'll have to go to Chicago. So Alex did that. And, you know, his recounting of it is that they never really talked about doing an autobiography of Malcolm X, but Elijah Muhammad liked Alex and, you know, thought he was, you know, trustworthy enough to take a chance on it, and so he gave his approval.
And at this time, Alex Haley is not somebody that you would think would be politically aligned with either Elijah Muhammad or Malcolm X.
Oh, no. I mean, Alex was very quick to tell everybody he met in New York that he totally rejected the Nation of Islam. He was a devout Christian. He did not approve of the anti-Semitic, anti-Christian, and anti-middle-class black attitudes that were prominent in the rhetoric of the Nation of Islam. So he disavowed all of it. And Malcolm understood that, and it is really a tribute, I think, to Haley, that Malcolm still trusted him to be his collaborator, even though Alex came from such a different and opposing point of view. And they, it was a remarkable period to try to collaborate on an autobiography, given the huge stresses in Malcolm X's life. Because they had just gotten started when the relationship between Malcolm and Elijah began really to fall apart. And many of the people around Elijah insisted that Malcolm was trying to undermine him, was trying to take over the sect, and Malcolm was an enemy of Elijah. And all of that was going on. And then the free talk about Elijah's people killing Malcolm began to emerge. And then Malcolm, in the midst of all that, takes off to Africa for months at a time. So it was a very difficult time to try to collaborate on writing a book. And of course, Malcolm was killed, in January of 65. And Haley still probably had no more than half of the book written at that point. So the book that comes out, that is produced out of this collaboration, is in part a sort of posthumous work.
Talk to me about the relationship between Malcolm X and Alex Haley. At first, Malcolm was pretty cold towards Alex Haley, and cold, I guess, is my term. You can explain it yourself. But eventually, they become very close during this process, to the point where Alex Haley even becomes the godfather of one of Malcolm's daughters.
Yes. Malcolm was just, his whole background was had taught him, trained him to be suspicious of people who conform to conventional American life. And Alex certainly had attempted to do that. And Alex was, close to people in the publishing world, all of them were white. And Alex had developed relationships with several black journalists, but Malcolm perceived him as essentially a spokesman for a white establishment. But, Alex was intent and diligent in getting the full story of Malcolm's life out. And when Malcolm would tell him something particularly disturbing, Malcolm would say, the white man ain't gonna let you put that in the book. But he did get, he certainly did get a whole lot of disturbing events in Malcolm's life into the book. And of course, that makes the book the powerful document that it is.
But he had a lot of difficulty after Malcolm X's death of getting that book published, even though he had a contract going into it.
Yeah, well, when Malcolm was assassinated on a Sunday afternoon, he was assassinated in Harlem, and New York was in tenterhooks for days. Expectation there was going to be war between the Nation of Islam and Malcolm's followers, because by then they were certainly widely split, that the people who had killed Malcolm were probably going to try to kill some more of Malcolm's followers, and that there was going to be essentially huge warfare in New York City. In the context of that, in the midst of that, Dumbledore.
And that was the fear. I mean, that's not what actually happened.
That was not what happened. The city stayed basically violence-free the next week, but there was a huge amount of fear promoted, especially in the newspapers. And in the context of that, Nelson Doubleday, the owner of Doubleday, canceled the publication of the autobiography of Malcolm X, saying that he feared that if they published the book, that there might, in fact, be shootouts in Doubleday's bookstores. Doubleday at that point, and for a long time after, owned several bookstores in New York City, and he was afraid of that just by publishing the book that they would be open and liable to all kinds of violence in their stores. And, you know, he owned the company, so he made it happen. And then they had their Haley was with no publisher and a book that was probably at that point 2/3 done. But he had this great agent, Paul Reynolds. And Reynolds, found another publisher and then finally squeezed the book out of Alex by June of 1965. And, you know, people thought it was an interesting, important treatment of an interesting fella. It was only, though, in the next couple of years, after the advent of the Black Power movement and the Black Panther Party, that Black nationalism began to be the kind of centerpiece of discussions about race in the aftermath of the mainline civil rights movement. And that gave incentive, sent lots of people looking for something to read to help them understand Black nationalism. And Autobiography of Malcolm X became a classic, essentially, for filling that need.
This the city of Chicago.
If the Chicago Police Department is going to have a healthy relationship with minority communities, then it must face some hard truths and acknowledge its racist past. Those tough words today from Chicago's Task Force on Police Accountability. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel appointed this panel following the release of a video that showed a white police officer shooting and killing a black teenager. The task force is now making sweeping recommendations to reform the nation's third largest police department. And NPR's David Shaper joins us from Chicago to discuss this report. Hi, David.
Hi, Ari.
The shooting of Laquan McDonald, the one we mentioned in that video, is not the only incident of its kind in Chicago. What are some of the panel's findings today?
Well, in this scathing report, the panel points that out exactly. And the task force takes direct, sharp aim at a culture within the Chicago Police Department that it says is rooted in racism, adding that the CPD's leadership is not doing enough to combat racial bias. The task force says this is a problem that did not just bubble up to the surface in the aftermath of the release of the Laquan McDonald video. In fact, racism and maltreatment at the hands of police has been consistent in terms of complaints from communities of color for decades. Lori Lightfoot is a former federal prosecutor who served as chairwoman of this police accountability task force, and she says the members held several community meetings and conducted scores of interviews before reaching this conclusion.
And one of the consistent themes that we heard from people all across the city was that they feel like the police do not respect their humanity. Many people said that they believe that the police that they encountered were fundamentally racist.
The report goes on to say that being stopped without justification, being exposed to verbal and physical abuse, being detained without access to counsel, it's all a history that has ended up fueling false arrests, coerced confessions, wrongful convictions, and has led to lives lost and countless more damage. So the task force report says reform can only begin with the Chicago Police Department acknowledging this long, sad history, as well as present conditions, which have left people totally alienated from the police and afraid for their safety.
Well, what does the report recommend the police department do now?
Well, some of the key recommendations focus specifically on accountability. And one of the key provisions of that is eliminating what is called the Independent Police Review Authority. This is the agency that investigates all police shootings and allegations of police misconduct. And they want to replace it with a new and fully transparent and accountable civilian police investigative agency. The task force members say there is a fundamental lack of accountability and a stunning lack of transparency within the Chicago Police Department. And as a result, IPRA is badly broken. Since its inception more than a decade ago, the agency has been criticized for incompetence, incomplete investigations, and being heavily biased in favor of the police, and rarely, if ever, holding police officers accountable for their wrongful conduct. So there's a whole long list of other changes in terms of training and accountability measures, and some of those focus on the collective bargaining agreement with the Chicago Police Union, which often serves to protect and, in fact, codify a code of silence that exists within the Chicago Police Department.
Just briefly, David, what's the reaction been from Mayor Emanuel?
Mayor Emanuel is applauding the task force efforts, say he'll take it under review and see what kind of recommendations they can implement. I should say that the mayor had his choice for new police superintendent approved by the city council today. Eddie Johnson is a 27-year veteran of the police department, and his major task going forward is going to sort through these recommendations and see what can be implemented rather quickly and what's going to take some time to get into implementation.
All right, it's NPR's David Schaefer. Thanks, David.
Thanks, Ari.
Hey, I know you don't smoke weed. I know this. But I'm going to get you high today. Because it's Friday. You ain't got no job. And you ain't got shit to do.
Many advocates for legalizing marijuana have argued that the drug's legalization would bring this country one step closer to ending the worst aspects of the war on drugs. A growing number of states have instituted or are considering bills that would decriminalize some form of marijuana. In fact, a front-page article in today's New York Times declares California's marijuana industry as a gold rush. But the effect of the war on drugs continues to cast a long shadow, as people who've been charged with drug crimes have been excluded from participating in this increasingly lucrative market. BuzzFeed News reporter Amanda Chicago Lewis has written recently about this issue, and her latest story on it is How Black People Are Being Shut Out of America's Weed Boom. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show now, along with Unique Henderson, one of the subjects of her piece. Amanda, Unique, welcome to our show.
Hey there, how's it going?
Okay. Amanda, can you talk a little about how you reported this story? How many people did you talk to?
A couple of hundred over maybe 8 months.
Are there any statistics about the racial makeup of people in the marijuana industry, the legal marijuana industry?
Well, I put together something of an educated guess after talking to lots of people in different markets. We have a pretty good estimate of how many marijuana dispensaries are in the country. That's sort of between 3,200 and 3,600. And because the market is small enough, it's not difficult to figure out or estimate how many African-American dispensary owners there might be. And I put that number at something around 36, which is about 1%.
So it's a pretty much a whites-only industry?
Yeah, it's very difficult to get involved in the marijuana industry as a person of color, especially if you have experience at all on the black market with selling or using marijuana.
But you say even without a criminal record, black people looking to get involved in legal weed face major obstacles. Like
yeah, there are major financial barriers to entry. It can cost tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars to even apply for a license in some of these states. And getting a legal weed business going costs at least $250,000. And because of, you know, centuries of systemic discrimination in education, housing, and employment, it's just much harder for people of color to have that kind of money on hand.
Are people with felony records allowed to work in any aspect of the industry?
No, unless you're in an unregulated state. So California, as it is right now, or Michigan, as they're transitioning into a formal system of regulation. But anywhere with regulations, if you have a drug felony on your record, you are restricted in certain ways from getting involved with the industry, from working retail behind the counter at a dispensary, from trimming cannabis at a cultivation center, to even investing in a business.
Are there any other industries where people with criminal records are legally barred from entering?
Yeah, I mean, people with criminal records are sort of treated as second-class citizens in this country. But the irony is particularly thick here and particularly unfair, especially considering that expertise in growing or manufacturing or processing cannabis is a valued skill in the legal, medical, and recreational industries. And so white people who are disproportionately not targeted or caught under the war on drugs who have expertise in marijuana are doing very well under legal and regulated systems.
But should we be concerned that anyone who was involved in the drug trade when it was illegal is barred from working in it today?
I mean, We could be concerned about that, but I think because marijuana is a crop, it's just very difficult to completely ignore all these people who have expertise in this drug. Also, if we're changing our standards of a society and we no longer think that this is something that is bad, I think that the people who've been working with it and who have been arguing that it is not bad for you for decades should be allowed to, you know, get a piece of the pie.
Yannick, can you tell us a little bit about your story? Weren't you a minor when you were arrested? What were you arrested for?
So, yeah, the first time I got arrested, I was in Oklahoma, Eden, Oklahoma. And me and a buddies got together, and we actually went to a park, you know, for a place to you know, kind of hang out. And one of my buddies who had the marijuana, he didn't know how to smoke. He didn't know how to roll up the joint. So he gave it to me because I just learned how to roll it. And, like, it's like a couple seconds later, the police pulled behind us and pretty much got arrested.
Do you think that you were being racially profiled? Because people of all races smoke marijuana.
Correct. At first, no, I wouldn't say that. But as the process went on, as me getting arrested, yes, because the guys that I were with were white. I had two white friends with me and a Mexican guy with me as well. And me and the Mexican guy, we got arrested. The two white guys, they went let free. And they had a case, I think it was a case of 24-pack of beer in the back of the truck. We wasn't old enough to drink yet. And, you know, they still let them go. And, you know, I felt like it was racial profile after the fact.
How did you plead? Did you have a lawyer?
Did I have a lawyer the first time? I believe I did.
Mm-hmm. Court-appointed lawyer.
Correct.
Now, this occurred when you were a teenager. Does it remain with you as a criminal record?
It still does to this day. It was for forever.
There's no way that it could ever be expunged?
Nope. It would be nice if it could, but, yeah, it's on my record forever.
So,
and every place that I apply to, they're going to see it, or anything like that, they're going to know exactly what I did as a child, which is fine, but... You know, it's something. It was so petty. It should go away.
Now you live in. Like, go ahead, finish.
I was just gonna say it's not like it was a big crime, you know, that I did. It was just marijuana.
Do we know why, Amanda? Why that kind of record isn't expunged, since it was a minor crime and he was, a minor.
Well, I mean, I'm not familiar with the vagaries of Oklahoma law, but I can say that there are a lot of people who have felonies on their record from, you know, age 17 or 18, you know, based on different standards in different states.
Now, Yannick, you're now living in Colorado, where marijuana is legal. Didn't you attempt to break into the legal marijuana industry?
Of course. When it first came out here, I was kind of excited. Because, you know, I've never seen anything like that. And, you know, as a young guy, you always think, like, if they did that here in America, that'd be great. It's finally coming here. So they actually had it was like a Greenway University that came out here to Denver, Colorado, and they were giving out classes to people that wanted to get into the business. So me and my ex-girlfriend, we went out and spent some money, a few hundred dollars, to basically take the classes, and we got a one-on-one with the professor so he could tell us how to grow and open up our business and, you know, try to be successful. So, you know, I was on it as soon as they came out here.
And then you were hoping to open up a business of your own?
Correct.
Colorado a particularly good place to grow marijuana? Is the soil good for marijuana?
Actually, I heard it's one of the best places to grow marijuana out here. It's just what I heard.
So what happened? So you have to apply for a license?
Yeah, so you have to, you know, after I did, went through all the classes and everything, my first step was to try to get a job. So I went to try to get a job. One of my friends out here, he was trying to get a job in the marijuana industry as well. So we both applied for the job. A couple weeks later, a few days later, I can't remember, he got the job, and I was just wondering why I didn't get the job. And, you know, I would call the dispensary and ask them, you know, check on my resume and stuff like that. They said, oh, somebody would get back with me. Nobody ever got back with me. Nobody ever told me why I never got the job.
What had you been doing in the interim? What had you been doing for a living before you decided to try to get into the marijuana business?
Before I did that, I think I was trying to find jobs around here. I was working with my girlfriend's, her dad. He owns a produce company out here. And I was a driver for him. And then one day my brother, he just like, you know, because I'm real big into music. And my brother, he just told me to, you know, go to school. Why don't you go to school for radio? So I kind of did that, took that route, and that's how I started getting established out here as work. But before then, it was kind of hard struggle because I was on the run for 10 years or plus because of my marijuana deal back in Oklahoma. Because I actually got caught twice with marijuana in Oklahoma. And the second time, you know, I was just scared. I didn't know what to do. I the police, they was trying to get me to snitch on, you know, somebody, other people. And that just wasn't me. And so I just got scared and I ran and I ended up here.
I'm speaking with Unique Henderson, who's the subject, one of the subjects in a piece by Amanda Chicago Lewis, a BuzzFeed news reporter. The piece is How Black People Are Being Shut Out of America's Weed Boom. And we will continue our conversation after we take this break. And we are back with BuzzFeed news reporter Amanda Chicago Lewis, who's written recently about the marijuana trade. Her latest story is How Black People Are Being Shut Out of America's Weed Boom. Also, Unique Henderson, one of the subjects of that piece. Amanda, you say that making it a white industry, barring African Americans from entering, is intentional. What made you think that? What made you come up with that idea?
Well, I think that the law enforcement lobby and the political people who are putting together and are very influential in terms of the laws that are regulating this industry intentionally want it to appear safe and very organized and regulated so that people feel more comfortable with this drug that was very recently illegal and is still illegal in many places. And is still federally illegal, becoming sold in a legal way. So I think that the type of people that certainly local officials and these licensing boards that are giving licenses out are looking for are, you know, Wall Street types, Silicon Valley types, white guys who already have some sort of business in the state and who are somehow established. And those are the people that they feel appear trustworthy, even if those people in reality are not trustworthy.
It's often claimed that the war on drugs is, in effect, a war in African-American communities. And we recently had Dan Baum as a guest on our show. He discussed interviewing John Ehrlichman, who was the domestic policy advisor for President Nixon, about his role in the war on drugs.
He said, can we cut the BS? Can I just tell you what this was about? And he said the Richard Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House thereafter had two enemies, black people and the anti-war left. We knew that if we could associate marijuana with the hippies and heroin with the blacks, we could demonize them night after night on the evening news. We could disrupt their meetings. We could arrest their leaders. We could harass them with the police endlessly. He said, did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did.
Unique, as someone who was charged with a felony for a tiny amount of marijuana, who was likely racially profiled, what were you thinking when you heard that clip?
It's kind of hard, like to know that people can just do that and just target a certain kind of people. It just kind of hurt me a little bit.
Well, he was suggesting that it was a political strategy.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is. You know, everything is political now. Everything.
Note to all politicians, stop making jokes about race-related matters. Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City, who is married to a black woman and has been considered an ally in many circles of social justice, decided that he and Hillary Clinton would do a bit about CP time, as it's known. If you're not familiar, that's an old trope that basically implies black people are always late. But in their hilarious exchange Monday night, the two decided, with an actor from Broadway's Hamilton on stage no less, to switch up that abbreviation to mean cautious politician. Time. Very clever, guys. Listen, being married to, friends with, or insert any other relationship here doesn't shield things that those who aren't people of color say from being offensive and or racist. Cut it out. And with her husband popping off recklessly as well, it appears Hillary's campaign is moving backwards. I'm Clinton Yates, and that's my take.
But at the end of the day, I'm rolling with HRC to the end because I think she gives a serious indication of what's happening in this country racially. So we can have Black Lives Matter articulating their concerns and Hillary Clinton responding to them better, by the way, than the occupant of the White House and others who claim to be the friends of African-American people as well.
The presidential primary in New York is less than a week away, and the Democratic candidates are making their case to the National Action Network. That's the civil rights group in New York City led by the Reverend Al Sharpton. Today, the group heard from Hillary Clinton, who's dealing with some missteps with black voters over the past week. Here's NPR's Tamara Keith.
Hillary Clinton told an almost entirely African-American audience at the National Action Network convention, race still plays a significant role in determining who gets ahead and who gets left behind.
There's something wrong, my friends, when the median wealth for black families is a tiny fraction of the median wealth for white families.
She hit recurring themes from her campaign about breaking down barriers and bringing the country together, and owned her privilege as a white American. For Clinton, this comes after a week of less than favorable press for her campaign. First, there was her husband Bill Clinton's confrontation with Black Lives Matter activists.
I like protesters, but the ones that won't let you answer are afraid of the truth.
In a more than 10-minute exchange with the activists, Bill Clinton defended some of the more controversial elements of his presidency, the 1994 crime bill and the 1996 welfare reform. And then there was the comedy routine at a New York City gala, where Hillary Clinton joined with Mayor Bill de Blasio to perform a joke taken by many to be racially insensitive. But you wouldn't know Clinton was having a rough week by the response to her speech today.
Hearing her speak today really brought tears to my eyes.
Really. Sylvia Dummett is a pastor from the Bronx, and she doesn't hold President Clinton's policies against his wife.
But she's willing to make some changes. So I'm holding her accountable to the things that she said today. I can't look back at what decisions that they made back then, because at that time, it was relevant. It was relevant for welfare reform. It was.
Dummett says she likes some of Senator Bernie Sanders' ideas, but she's all in for Clinton because of her tenacity. Demographically, if you had to pick an audience most likely to support Clinton, it would be this one. Her strongest support this election cycle has come from African Americans over 30 years old. But Tad Devine, a senior advisor to the Sanders campaign, says in Wisconsin, the senator made some inroads with black voters, and he expects that to continue in New York by highlighting Sanders' lifelong commitment to civil rights.
So we've got to tell his story, his own narrative, and most importantly, we've got to make sure that the African-American community knows about the policies that he wants to pursue as president to achieve racial justice in America, to deal with the economic disparities that are so profound on the African-American community.
Sanders spoke here last year and will address the convention again tomorrow. Based on interviews with attendees, their support for Clinton wasn't for lack of knowing about Sanders. Paulette Roca said on a scale of 1 to 10, she'd give Clinton's remarks an 11.
We can understand her. We can relate to her. I know I can. I like her. I feel very comfortable with her. She has respect. When black women respect you, you got respect.
And in the lead up to the primary here in New York, Clinton has been working hard to shore up that support.
Father, can you hear me now?
In the last 2 weeks, Clinton has visited 6 black churches.
Oh, this is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it.
That's on pace with her run for Senate in 2000, when, by WNYC's count, Clinton visited 27 black churches in 2 months. In New York, black voters made up 17% of the primary electorate in 2008. And if Clinton wins on Tuesday, it may well be because of their support. Tamara Keith, NPR News, New York.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. HRC to the end. Compensatory call-in. Folks have commentary they would like to share. Anything on the news clips, observations from the past 7 days. Certainly we will make time for workplace racism as well. Feel free to chime in. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Just that last 60 seconds of that clip right there, I can totally understand any black person, any non-white person in the universe who becomes disinterested in politics. That right there, that 60-second exchange where I got to listen to Hillary Clinton or any other white politician up in a pulpit, this is the day the Lord has made, and I'm just here to count on your Negro support. That right there would be more than enough to have me check out and say, I am cool in the gang. I will do something else with my time and energy if this is what participating in the whole ballot process is going to be about. If this is what I'm going to have to endure, these are going to be my options for folks that I got to pick from, I'm cool in the gang. Let's go home and watch Empire. Not telling anybody not to vote, but just saying I can totally empathize with anybody who says, I'm cool, I'm done with the whole voting process. Quick tidbits that I'll get before we get to the phone line. Number one, we had some beefier segments this week. They were longer in duration, and I will certainly take any criticism. Folks say, man, Gus, you're just being lazy and planning these longer segments. You could have got in more clips so we could have got more information about things that happened over the past week. That is certainly true. But the segment on Mexico, I was going to play that regardless of what had to happen, just because I'm very interested in hearing more about black people in Mexico, other areas of Latin America, so-called Latin America, South America, Brazil, other regions where I don't think people as frequently think, oh, there are black people here. And not only are there black people here, but they are also victims of white supremacy and what's happening with them. I thought that was just a fascinating segment. And we had live cows. I don't remember the last time that there have actually been live cows heard on the context of white supremacy. But there were many reasons that I was very pleased to hear that segment. And that segment was actually about an hour program, and I just kind of cut it down to 20 minutes. I might even encourage folks to check out the whole thing because it was very, very interesting to hear. Anywho, the segment on Alex Haley, which was also fascinating, that one too, I kept saying, well, okay, well, I'll just play a little bit. And then they just kept going. And I was like, wow, I can't really find a spot to cut this short, because the segment he was talking about Miles Davis, I thought that was pretty interesting. Certainly the information about Malcolm X and how that influenced him. Since we did Malcolm X's autobiography in the book club last year, I know we've had listeners who've called in to talk about their thoughts on Roots, and was it an authentic presentation of that era of racism, white supremacy on the plantation, and thoughts about that. How did people respond when that film aired in 1977 and what have you? We had talked about that. The accusations, not even accusations, it is fact, unless I've been misinformed, about the fabrications that went into Roots and even the plagiarism that went into it. A lot of those themes had come up on the program before, so there were just a lot of different elements to that clip. And a white person who did this biography, which is always something that I think is suspicious, that you should have high alert and be very mindful when it is a suspected race soldier who's doing these type of projects, if they have an ulterior ulterior motive, if you're not getting all the accurate information, if they're practicing racism on how the book is written and what have you. I have not read the book. It just came out recently. That's why I wanted to play it, kind of give folks on alert. If you see it or people are talking about it, academic circles or elsewhere, might be something that you want to be mindful of, might even be worth taking the time to read the text to see what information is there. But that was why I played that one as well. Some of the other segments I thought were pretty important also. Anywho, other quick notes that I wanted to get in before. We ended with the segment on Hillary Clinton. There was a significant article in the New York Times this week talking about that very element, Hillary Clinton and her effort to get black people to support her campaign for presidency. The report that was in the New York Times, Mothers of Black Victims Emerge as a Force for Hillary Clinton. And it's got a picture of Eric Garner, the black male in New York who was choked to death in 2014. It has his mother, Gwen Carr, and it's significantly the photograph has her, and it's got a huge picture of a crucifix in the background. They're in a church or some religious facility, someplace where they have a lit cross in the background. So you get that first, and then they move to the article. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'll read enough so that you get some of the flavoring of this piece. So they write, "The Sweet Maple Cafe in Chicago, famous for its grilled cheese sandwiches and sweet milk biscuits, typically closes each day after the lunch rush. But one evening in November, the restaurant opened for an unusual private dinner. The mothers of Michael Brown, Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, and Tamir Rice, and a half dozen other black women who had lost children in clashes with police or in gun violence were flown in from around the country and invited to gather around a table. They were joined by Hillary Clinton, who asked them one by one to tell their stories. She took her pad and her ink pen, she wrote her own notes, and she asked us, 'What did we need?' said Maria Hamilton, whose son, Dontre Hamilton, was shot 14 times by a white Milwaukee police officer in 2014. Mrs. Clinton appeared visibly hurt as the mothers spoke, said Lucia McBath, whose 17-year-old son, Jordan Davis, was fatally shot after playing loud music in his car in 2012. The gathering, held without aides or journalists present, stretched into a nearly three-hour dinner over pork chops and gravy, fried okra, and rice. After dessert of apple pie, Mrs. Clinton encouraged the women to organize and travel the country with her campaign." I will stop there. You can check out the report. It's not the longest thing I've ever read, but it's significantly longer than what I'm reading to give you further details about other black people that are supporting her. I cracked up laughing. Not that I'm laughing at any of these victims, because there's, you know, nothing funny about these tragedies, but just that I was waiting for them to say chitlins and fatback and, you know, anything else, sweet tea, and just to really play it up with all of just the images in how this is supposed to appeal to Negroes. I know black people. I can come and sit down and just have a blast with you black folks, and you can tell me all about your pain, and Mama Clinton will get it done. Even throw in a few biblical scriptures to show you that HRC can keep it real with her Negroes. It's just repulsive. The thing that stood out to me more than anything, I shared this piece on my Facebook page and let other folks check it out, encourage folks to read it. Again, this would be another example of anybody who says, hey, I am not down with the whole election process. This is, you know, repulsive and I'm not going to participate. I totally empathize. Not that I'm encouraging anyone to not vote. But I saw people responding and they were upset, but they were upset with the victims. Eric Garner's mother, Gwen Carr, and Sabrina Fulton, Trayvon Martin's mother, and some of these other folks. And, I mean, certainly everybody has VGQ, but in my opinion, that is not the correct target. Any of the frustration or anger should be directed at suspected white terrorist Hillary Clinton and all of the white people who are organizing her campaign who set this up. All of these black people that are engaged in this, I wouldn't care if they vote for Hillary Clinton. I wouldn't care if they went out and wrote letters for her every day, campaigned for her, got tattoos of her and Bill Clinton all over their body, and took special time to write nasty things about Gus T. Renegade. I would not care. They are victims of racism who I cannot even fathom the trauma that these individuals have experienced in losing a black child. I mean, it in my view, is totally logical. They might not even be processing things accurately. I suspect some of these folks are still in a state of trauma with the loss that they have had to deal with, and then the ensuing legal struggles and going to court and all this other stuff that they've had to deal with. I would strongly suspect that they're not even process things accurately in a system of racism, white supremacy, with everything that they've had to deal with. So I would just encourage, this is not one. And I think, again, whites, they do a phenomenal job of setting things up so that we consistently take our frustrations out and target other victims of racism. That's not going to solve this problem. To sit around and say, well, Trayvon Martin and any other black person who's supporting Hillary Clinton, they're an Uncle Tom, they're a Sambo, they're a sellout, or any other titles that we want to come up with, I don't think that's going to solve the problem. I think at the end of the day, understanding how sophisticated racist white supremacists are, being able to come in and get us to not be suspicious, not think of them as an enemy, understanding how that process works so that we can do a better job seeing it, evading it, countering it, and getting that information to other victims of racism so all of us can do a better job neutralizing racist woman, racist man, racist child. My opinion. Other thoughts quickly before I hit the folks who dialed in. Jackie Robinson, the documentary was referenced yesterday. It came out on PBS yesterday on the Life and Times of Jackie Robinson. That's another project that was done by a white man, Ken Burns, suspected racist. He does have a history of doing a lot of documentary films that directly deal with racism. He also did probably one of my favorite documentaries, one of my favorite just period films of all time, Jack Johnson, Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson, which is absolutely incredible. I would encourage folks to check that out as well. That was also on PBS. His daughter, Sarah Burns, they worked on the project Central Park Five about the rape case in New York, featuring short snippet on Donald Trump in there as well. But folks can check that out. I would also encourage, if you are going to watch that documentary, it is available online. I posted the link yesterday. Jackie Robinson wrote books, man. Like, you can read directly from him what he had to say about racism, white supremacy. They quote from his last book before he transitioned, I Never Had It Made, which is outstanding, where he gives a lot of personal thoughts about what he experienced both while he was playing baseball, while he was in the armed services, and the racism that he experienced there, and his post-baseball career. He gives a lot of great detail. Always great if you can go directly to the source, particularly if it's a black person, to hear what they had to say without that white filter on the voice. I think with that, I am willing to conclude. I will stop there. Folks have commentary they would like to share. Feel free. The number is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. If you could limit your commentary to 5 minutes, that would be great. Make sure everybody has an opportunity to share. I'll try to be mindful to make sure I'm keeping that so I can kind of give you a prompt if you have done your five. No metaphors for the compensatory call-in. Make sure that I'm alert to that myself. Again, it's just to make an effort to make sure that we're being clear, explicit about what it is that we're trying to say. Frequently, racists and victims of racism employ a lot of metaphors, analogies, comparisons that are not accurate and frequently end up obscuring what it is that we are trying to say. I think racists do this deliberately to be deceptive, comparing things that are not equivalent to just further add confusion about what racism is and how it works. I think sometimes victims do this just not even thinking we do it, where we're not even conscious of the errors that are being made and how we are verbally articulating ourselves. But no metaphors. If we could just be explicit, clear about what it is that we want to say, that would be outstanding. And I'll challenge myself to let folks know when you are indeed using metaphors. Watch the background noise. Thank you kindly. If you could keep that down to a minimum, use your mute button. If you know you're in a loud place where other folks are talking and being rowdy, or people have, you know, television, radio on in the background or what have you, if you can use your mute button, that'll be great. Then I can just keep your line open. So if we have opportunity for you to get additional comments in, we can do so. With that, all the folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should, well, that is not true. About the first half of the people who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. Feel free.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. My name is Thomas Smith in New York. I had a few observations to make. One, I haven't heard anyone make this correlation yet, but, you know, we usually say we have Dr. Wellesley moment, so I had a Dr. Blair moment, and I just wanted to share it with everyone because I don't believe in coincidence under the system of white supremacy. And as, you know, we should all know, I don't know if everyone knows, but the U.S. has a very powerful machine called HAARP, H-A-A-R-P, that can cause tsunamis and hurricanes and earthquakes, et cetera. So I just thought it was very ironic that on April 14th, 2010, China gets hit with the first of a series of devastating earthquakes. On the same day, it was reported that they became the U.S. largest debt holder and therefore the U.S. largest creditor. And then this week, on April 14, 2016, Japan gets hit with a first of a devastated series of earthquakes. On the day, it's reported that they became the U.S. largest debt holder and therefore the U.S. largest creditor. So I don't know if you could say that's a coincidence or a conspiracy, but I just thought that was very interesting. Same day, same set of events, and they get hit with the earthquakes in the same fashion. The BBC thing you ran, very interesting. First, you know, BBC must be supporting Donald Trump, you know, running a story about Afro-Mexicans. Man, that wall just grew about 3-4 extra feet. I never knew that in modern times there were black cowboys that didn't wear a Dallas uniform. I mean, I was very interested in real cows that eat grass and make dung. Not these white people made GMO cows that eat corn and make E. coli. But the Mexican government said there were no black Mexicans, so they deported them to Haiti. And I found that very interesting because there's several black countries that surround Mexico, like Belize and Honduras and Panama, but they send them to the most victimized black country in the world, Haiti. And I just thought that was extremely tacky and racist. Alex Haley's career started with him writing love letters to white women. Very interesting. But, you know, what I got from that story is the white media is so powerful. The propaganda about the Muslim war between Malcolm X's faction and Elijah Muhammad's faction of the Nation of Islam, you know, reporting that every day in the newspaper, just planting the seeds and spreading rumors like the media is known to do. Usually that type of stuff causes a war, you know, after you start believing what they're right. And I just think it was a huge show of black self-respect for them not to get caught up in that. So I say kudos to the 1960s black Muslim movements for not falling for that dirty trick. The weed dispensary, 36 black-owned weed dispensary, over 3,000 out of over 3,000 weed dispensaries. And I just thought, man, after all the advertising and promotion of weed use by the black rappers and, you know, all the black movies from Friday to, you know, Half-Baked or whatever. And out of all of that, all we get is about 1% of the market. Just extremely white supremacist. Dangerous white women. You know, Microsoft and Twitter, they create this robotic artificial intelligence. They call it TAG. And it's designed to replicate the mindset of a 19-year-old female, which means a white female, of course. And they had to stop it because TAG started using offensive language. And one of the tweets was, Bush did 9/11 and Hitler would have done a better job than the monkeys we have now. Donald Trump is the only hope we got. And I just said, man, they tried to make an artificial, intelligent mindset of a white female, and this is what it started doing, even a robotic one. Can't help itself and be racist. I'll mute my line and thank you very much for taking my call, Gun.
For sure. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, do you all have commentary?
Hello?
Yes, sir, M1. If you could speak up, that would be helpful.
Oh, good. I'll be very quick. The Hillary Clinton candidacy, you know, like yourself, I was absolutely disgusted with that whole church segment as well as the other parts of it. Now, I'm not very fan of support it either, but I do like the fact that he is actually giving her a fight. You know, this basically was just supposed to be her reward for losing to President Obama. But now Bernie Sanders is winning races, getting delegates, and believe it or not, the map is still there that he can take it. And again, it's not that I'm supporting him, but I just don't like the idea that people are just trying to reward her with this nomination. So they pick, so like the, what was supposed to be the weakest opponent for her. One quit, and then the guy that stood on and stayed on, he was supposed to be gone by now, but he's hanging in there. Again, not voting for either of them, but I just appreciate the fact that this isn't easy for her. And as for Alex Haley, I don't know whether plagiarized or not, you know, Ruth is plagiarized or not, but the usual dismissive comments, like how that author talked about him having, if you're reading, you have a natural talent for writing, and he had natural ability to be a writer. You know, that's just something that is, you know, that's that other stereotype, like, other people work hard. Other people study, but not us. Any abilities we have is somehow natural. And as for that author, that Village Voice author, there's a gentleman that wrote that article on Alex Haley. There's a gentleman named Philip Nobile. I remember that very well. See, he deceived a lot of people because he had written this article on black anchors and how they weren't standing up to the places they worked at. You know, in other words, he was presenting himself as this champion. He's presenting himself as this champion of speaking out, whereas these black anchors weren't. And I even remember him on what was the premier black station at this time, WLIV, getting a lot of applause for it, right at the Apollo Theater. But then he wrote other articles, which, of course, revealed who he really was. Where he wrote an article on Tawana Brawley, and he is interviewing, and in the article, he describes her as a 15-year-old and girl. Now, when he's asked about it, he was like, I was not being racist. I was using the language of a white supremacist. And then came the Alex Haley article, so people figured out who he was. But again, he initially got the applause by deception. And one last thing on Roots. I mean,
when Django Unchained was released, he actually made the statement that he didn't find anything in Roots legible. You know, as if that monstrosity he wrote, Django Unchained, was. That's all I have to say.
For sure. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up that we have not heard from, line should be open. Feel free to chime in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, just a few things. So I pay attention to, I caught some of the clip with Haley's biographer, and I didn't really like how he explained Roots as it helped Americans own their history, because as far as I'm concerned, white people wherever in the States and, of course, everywhere else, still deny that white supremacy exists. And I find when they frame thing at, what I find that it does is it creates this, or sorry, continues to perpetuate this narrative of progress. I think that is one of the biggest ways to confuse people is, you know, we're progressing, even though the system is still intact. It's really just refining itself. I also didn't kind of like the idea that when they're talking about the differences between Alex Haley and Malcolm X, it kind of goes back to this notion, which has always bothered me, that somehow being of a certain class status limits or hides the effects of white supremacy, or that only a certain group or certain quote unquote class of black people are confused. And I find the same confusion among black people in every different context when it comes to understanding white supremacy. One thing that I liked is in the clip where they were talking about the Chicago Police Department. I think it was a soundbite within the clip, if I'm not mistaken, where one person, I don't know if it was a victim, that said, the woman was saying that the people in the community realize that the police are fundamentally racist. I was actually glad to see that, especially in light of what's happening in Toronto. Toronto's starting to confront the fact that its police department is fundamentally racist. And then the clip with Clinton, the type of feelings I have over this, I know, like, we have to understand that certain black people get confused, and I think particularly those women in particular being in an emotionally vulnerable state. This is exactly why I actually like Bernie Sanders compared to Clinton, because I think the more skeptical black people are of a white person, I think that's the best white person for black people, the one that forces us to have to be suspicious. When we're not suspicious, oh my, the damage it does. That's why I love, quite frankly, it would be very beneficial for someone like a Donald Trump to be in Toronto, because that's exactly what former deceased white supremacist mayor Rob Ford would do. It was funny because I had one of my relatives was just saying, you know, we should forgive him, you know, he's human, exactly like how the woman in the clip or some of the black women in the clip talked about Clinton. So it was very difficult to listen to. And those are all my thoughts, and I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that. Rest in peace, Rob Ford, the legend. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, feel free.
Hello? Can I be heard? Oh, yes, yes. I'll go after you.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, sorry. It's my first time calling in. I have a few things that I wanted to kind of touch on. Listening to the clips, one thing that really pointed out to me was the clip about the young man who was trying to get into the whole dispensary business, and it's just really disheartening because, I may sound a little emotional. I had to visit some relatives today, and a lot of them engage in, you know, escapism as far as marijuana use and a lot of alcohol consumption, and I mean, with everything that's going on, I understand that it's hard for people to face day-to-day things, but it's really emotional because these people that I visit, these relatives and friends, I mean, they really remind me of, like, zombies. And so to see that more and more people are just accepting that, okay, marijuana is going to be legal, it's just, it's a slippery slope. And I know people have their own opinions about it, but just knowing how it's affecting so many people and they're just not even aware, it's just really like they're zombies. So that's something that really concerns me. And also with the mothers of all these slain men, and how they're just gathering around Hillary Clinton. And, I mean, I don't know whether they're just not watching the news, and I'm sure they can't escape all the things they're hearing, the sound bits of things she said about white people calling us super predators and this and that, and even her joke with de Blasio. I mean, it's just, it's very offensive. And I have to really stop myself from judging because I've been there too, so I'm not acting as if, you know, I probably wouldn't have been that way. And like Dust mentioned earlier, you know, they're probably not even processing everything well because, you know, they're probably still grieving. But still, I mean, she is a known liar, and I don't know. I think the feminism piece has a lot to do with it because personally I know just talking to females that I know, they really identify with her. Sort of like, I guess because Bill and all his affairs, they seem to side with Hillary because of that, which is crazy to me. It doesn't make sense to me, but they'll say things like, you know, she stands by her man through all this stuff. And yeah, I'm just listening like I'm in the Matrix or something. But anyway, that's all I wanted to touch on.
First time caller. Woohoo. Good to hear from you. Zombie, that would be a metaphor, but very glad to hear from first time caller.
Sorry.
No apologies. No apologies. All of us trying to get better. Victims of racism all. Good you could chime in as well. Roz, were you gonna comment as well, sir?
Yes, greetings to you guys and to all the callers and the listeners. First, I just wanted to chime in on the clip you played. Actually, was that we discussed or news event that we discussed late last year in regards to on Kane University campus, there was threats to black people about black people getting shot and things like that, and they found out that it was a black female who was behind that whole incident. And for the last about 2 weeks now, she's been in and out of court. And she was trying to get an appeal because I think she's facing like a 5 to 7 year sentence, and she was trying to get an appeal. And the white judge completely threw her appeal out of court, so he's going to try and throw the book at her. And when I was looking at her in the news clip, she looked like she might be mentally ill. And when I talked to my son about her today, he said that he knows a couple of people who personally know her. And they actually said from back then, years ago, she exhibited signs of mental illness. They don't know what's wrong with her. But I just saw it just in the news clips, how she looked when they were when they had her in front of the judge. So it's just a shame that she's not going to get the mental health that she needs. But this white predator is now going to throw the book at her, and she's now facing prison time just for making a stupid move. That turned out to be considered a quote-unquote terroristic act by this situation. So I just wanted to talk about that first. In reference to the clip on African-Mexicans, I thought that it was very fascinating. It's something that I was always very interested in as well. Dr. Ivan Van Sertima was one of the people who taught me, so that was one of his specialties. And it's funny because when I went to Egypt with one of his students, Fanoka Rashidi, he had an African-American female college professor who specialized in Afro-Mexican history. And she gave us quite a bit of information on them. And actually, we found out that one of the giant stone heads, they have them in La Venta, Mexico, and a couple other cities that basically have African features or African Asian features. There was a replica that was donated in 2010 by Mexico to Ethiopia in homage to, first of all, Ethiopia being one of the places where the first humans came from, and then second of all, the fact that the Olmec people, certain sections of them were direct descendants from Ethiopia who migrated to Mexico in that time frame. So I just found that to be very fascinating, and I wanted to say thanks for that clip. Also, the clip on Alex Haley and is working on the autobiography of Malcolm X, I just found that very interesting because when Alex Haley had written the article, there was an article that he had written called Black Merchants of Hate about the Nation of Islam in 1963, and he wrote it with another black journalist named Alfred Balk. And Alfred Balk had direct connections to the FBI. And Manning Marable, he was on Democracy Now! And discussed the fact that that article that he wrote with Mr. Balk was the foundation of what set the precedent for how he would write the autobiography of Malcolm X. And I just found it interesting because they clarified that Alex Haley was not directly in contact with the FBI from what Manning Marable was able to find out, but he would have been aware that Alfred Balk was in direct contact with the FBI. And I'm not 100% sure, but I also remember hearing that there were three missing chapters in the autobiography of Malcolm X, which from what I understand were actually some of the most important information that was left out. And that I don't know how true it is, but it's been said that Alex Haley had contacts with the FBI, and they were the ones who gave him the impetus to leave those three chapters out. I don't know how true that is. I'll be researching that probably in the coming months. Also, the clip with the black male who was hanging with his white friends and ended up getting arrested for marijuana and now has basically ruined his life, to me kind of exemplifies what would happen if marijuana was legalized. They would find some legal way to just railroad, or basically to just destroy a black male's life, I'll put it that way, not to use a metaphor, excuse me, simply because he was in the car with two white males, and the two white males were basically let go. Nothing happened to them. Their lives were not ruined, and he now has a permanent record that will never be expunged. So that really speaks to a lot of what Dr. Wilson talked about as far as that's concerned. Also, the clip regarding Bill de Blasio speaks to what we always say, that a person can be married to a black person, having tragic arrangements, sexual relationships, rape relationships with black people, and still be a practicing racist white supremacist, as is Bill de Blasio. So I just found that just a total revelation of, and a public figure who is married to a black female and is still a racist white supremacist. Lastly, as far as HRC, she has taken the biggest page out of her husband's playbook as far as her campaign, because she's running a campaign of white validation, and she's using these victims of white supremacy who have had children murdered by the system of white supremacy, and she's basically using them as a means to draw in the black vote. And sadly, these women, these mothers don't realize that they're being vampired. She is a psychopath. Sam Bachman, I think that a lot of what he talks about is exactly the traits that Hillary Clinton exhibits, and it's just a shame that so many black people are being fooled by this woman, because she is a predator of the worst kind. And thank you for taking my call, and with that, I'll mute my line.
Right. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if y'all had comments you wanted to share, feel free.
Yes, sir. Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
My first report I observed a couple of days ago on Yahoo that someone is attempting to come up with a quote-unquote updated version of Birth of a Nation. Did anybody get knowledge of that?
I think that's The Birth of a Nation, which is not Birth of a Nation, the project that came, the racist film that came out in the beginning of the 20th century. This is Nate Parker, who's a black male. I guess that would be a cowbell because he's married to a white female, but he's making a project that's supposed to be about Nat Turner, and it's The Birth of a Nation, and it got a lot of attention. It was at Sundance earlier this year, but I did see that on Yahoo this week. They've been talking about that. I think they released the trailer for the film this week. It's supposed to come out, I think, later this year on Fox Searchlight Pictures.
Is that some kind of a coincidence of the similar titles?
Oh, yeah, he did it intentionally. He talked about it at, at Sundance.
I think I get it. Number two, Mrs. Clinton, counseling parents of murdered children. I'm assuming that most of those parents are mothers. And as you stated in the beginning of the program, those non-white people who are confused and are going after these non-white black victims, have you mentioned traumatized? You know, I mean, can you imagine having to go to the morgue and identify your child's body? You know, I have an offspring, and you know, I mean, and I'm saying that to say that I know that slick people like Mrs. Clinton have that understanding, and they know on how vulnerable these victims are. They know how, and so from that standpoint, just approaching them, and she knows how to be nice. She knows how to be courteous. And from there, you know, the manipulation would go pretty strong on the psyche of those non-white black victims who would ask anybody, can you, especially because she's powerful. Can you help me in my dilemma, you know, over the death of my child? That needs to be understood by, you know, non-white victims who would criticize those parents. Visiting quote-unquote black churches. Once again, white people understand. A lot of white people understand. I would say most white people understand that these institutions are primarily, and it's not even a good veil over these churches, that the religion actually is white supremacy. Their understanding going into these places. And they have an understanding of our collective mental condition to whereas they can go in there and just about say anything and have us with tears coming out of our eyes and be willing to help them in any kind of way. So she's quite comfortable with that. She's quite comfortable with that. With that in and out of churches, especially according to what you are reporting, and she reminds me of a lot of white females that I experienced before I retired on that job, and they're very, very manipulative. They can be nice at the same time, and Mrs. Clinton is an expert at it. Is being sassy, she can cut you in a split second. I'm looking at a picture of her right now with a smile on her face, showing her teeth, but within half a second she can turn that into a growl. And we've all experienced that just off of looking at YouTube clips of her talking to Black Lives Matter or whatever, anybody. She's prepared. In that way. And she also is very careful of not to say a whole lot about the idea that, okay, now I will be the first female, you know. So she's also trying to bring that particular achievement into the picture without having to say it. And I think that's also very subtle but sneaky tactic that she is able to use to be able to attract a lot of non-white people, especially a lot of non-white black females. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
For sure. Before I nab some of the other folks who dialed in with a hand up, I just wanted to say really quick also about that about that clip where Unique, I think, was the victim's name, black male, where he got a record for cannabis possession and perhaps even use, where he said he was with some white people, and I think he said a quote-unquote Mexican. I suspect that might have been a non-white person. But he said the white person, or the people that he was with, non-black people, they didn't know how to roll the joint, so they gave it to him to roll. And then the police rolled up while he was the one holding the joint, and he ended up getting a charge, and the white people didn't. Man, if you needed another illustration of the danger of white friends, Exhibit A. And I said consistently, I think someone I hear regularly says sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I feel like I hear that on a regular basis. That might be another piece of evidence to support sobriety until we get this problem solved. Certainly, if you are going to go ahead and use any of these substances, I would not recommend being out and about, not with white people, but I certainly would not recommend being out and about. Try to get to a residence so you can be at least have a bit more protection than just being chilling out in a parking lot or something like that. That, in my view, is pretty much asking for race soldiers to come up and ruin your life. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, good evening to the host. Good evening to the callers and listeners. I actually have a question that I'd like to throw out for the listeners, the callers, and the host. The theme has been so far in the conversation and the commentary that a lot of victims criticize other victims. Now, does anyone have any strategies? If case in point, I have a friend, very good friend. We talk about a lot of issues that are plaguing our community. And I definitely sympathize with black people. And I try to explain to her that, you know, black people, we've been through a lot. We're still going through a lot. I even gave the example, like, we cannot escape white people. I mean, so much so that even a carton of your orange juice you pull out of the refrigerator would have a white face on it. So white people are always in our presence, even though we can't get away from them. And they're always in our presence. I don't watch the television often, but we just cannot escape them. They're even in our homes when we don't exactly personally invite them in our homes. So I just wanted to know if anyone has found any effective strategies to really convey to another victim, look, we really need to have sympathy for each other. We have to stop talking badly and negatively about each other. Yes, there's some things that might be obvious to you and obvious to myself, but it's not obvious to a lot of black people. We're still confused, even if she or myself think that we have more clarity than someone else, we still can possibly succumb. We still are in this system. So does anyone have any strategies on how to, I don't know if you can make someone more sympathetic to our plight, but effective ways to kind of communicate and convey to other victims that, look, we are in a system and this system is, it's very covert, it's overt, and still there's a lot of confusion, and we really need to have a little bit more sympathy. I will mute my line. Thank you for any suggestions.
Great. Great question. We will, I guess the easiest way to...
Session.
Oh, right on. I guess the easiest way to try to respond to this, all
can
of the...
Can I speak to...
Hang on one second. All the people that have not shared yet, I still want to try and get them, and then we can go backwards to the people that have already shared, if you all want to respond to her question, because we still have quite a few folks who haven't shared at all. The only thing I can say quickly would be... if you can reflect honestly from yourself, I've seen where that can work. And when I say that, I mean I reference myself. I will start with Gus T. Renegade in emphasizing that I was not born with information about racism, white supremacy, and I always was not doing the correct thing. Even still now, struggle to make the correct decision in terms of what to do, what not to do, and just understanding that, you know, with all black people victims of racism, that we are all victims, and you just don't know what information a person has been exposed to, and it's most likely that that person has not had accurate information about racism, white supremacy, and what are things that we should be doing to try to neutralize this problem. I also try to use examples that I think people will know. I found that it seems most people, they're familiar with Minister Malcolm X to some degree. He was not always Minister Malcolm X. There was a Detroit Red in there who was not doing constructive things about racism, white supremacy. If you want to even go Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, now that I do have photographs of Dr. Welsing, with chemically mutilated hair. That would be another great representation that, hey, you can only do as much as what you know. After you get better information, you make better, different decisions. And I have found that that works a lot when you're not attacking that person specifically, when you can reference yourself. So I'm not trying to put you down. It's just, hey, all of us, I think all of us can say that we have made poor choices under this system. And just as you get better information, you try to make better decisions. The people that have not shared at all will go there, and then if other folks want to respond to that question or have a different additional comments, we'll make time for that as we roll. The person at, I see the female caller in Ohio, did you have commentary you wanted to get in also?
Yes, have we heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Good evening to Gus, the host. Good evening to all the other callers online. The story about the marijuana... The guy, you know, at the marijuana, and like you were saying, you know, when black people talk about white friends, I mean, how much more obvious can things get, you know, now? And then when the lady, woman that the gentleman was talking to, and she basically said, you know, that keeping black people out of this marijuana business, like, yes, you know, it's deliberate. I mean, it's just the blatantness of the story. I'm not shocked, but it's just still something that's shocking about it, which maybe it shouldn't be, but I don't know. It just makes me shake my head. In terms of Hillary Clinton, you know, I'm just going to say this. I can remember right after President Obama was reelected, and for a minute the media had this flurry about Hillary, and they were talking about just, you know, her, you know, will she run, and, you know, a lot of stuff. And I can remember telling a friend of mine, I said, he just got reelected. Let him at least bask for a minute in his victory, talking about President Obama, before you jump into Hillary. But they were just really just going strong, you know, about Hillary back then. And I can remember talking to a personal friend of mine, and she made the statement. She says, I remember I told her, I just this next upcoming election, you know, I just don't feel good about it. And I remember she made a statement to me. She said, yes, she said, you know, we don't elect Hillary. She said, we're going to be blank, you know what I mean, going to be just messed over. But, you know, that wasn't the word she used. And I remember I was, you know, talking to her on the phone. So when she said it, I mean, I kind of rolled my eyes up in the head, because I'm saying to myself, you know, no matter who we elect, including Hillary, we're going to be screwed. But that was just me. And so, you know, to hear the piece about the churches, I work with a young lady, and she told me about maybe 3 or 4 months ago or something, the church that she go to, I remember I'm in Ohio, she lives in Cleveland, she said, you know, that Hillary Clinton had came to her church, that, you know, one morning, and I was just like, wow. So, it is amazing to me how... you know, because I asked a question to a friend of mine. I'm like, so are black people going to demand things of Hillary for their vote, or are they just going to give their vote to Hillary? And it, from stuff that I'm looking at, it's just like they're just giving their vote to Hillary. And I don't support Hillary. I didn't even like her when she was the first lady. So I just don't like the woman. And I don't support Bernie, you know. So, you know, as we, you know, move on down the road, you know, come November the 4th, I know I'm going to vote, but I don't, you know, I don't know for who. But, I mean, today is the day that's been, you know, I mean, it's coming. But I just, I'm almost like astounded when I listen to black people, or I read things that black people say, and it is almost as if Hillary is God. And it is just unbelievable. And, you know, and so when I get into some of my Facebook groups and I ask questions, and when people, you know, they say, well, look at their record. So then, you know, you come back with some stuff you found in their record, then they get angry at you. You know, and I'm just like, come on. So, you know, you guys are just going to totally ignore the things that, and even though they say, well, you know, this is her husband, it's like, that's her husband, though. They share the same pillow. That's her husband. They work as a team. You know, she was the one running around the country, you know, extolling the crime bill, and she was the one who called black kids super predators. And I read comments from black people saying, well, you know, we do have black people that are super predators. So it is amazing to me, and I don't mean that in a good sense. That's just a word. That's how I use it. I don't necessarily mean that in a good sense. But just like you say, to hear that, you know, that little piece in the church where she was saying, I mean, just almost when you want to just barf, because I'm just like, come on, you know, it just sounds so horrible. So I'll mute myself, but that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if folks that we have not heard from, if you have your own comments and or you want to respond to the question about how you encourage sympathy for other black people, victims of white supremacy, feel free. Do we have any female callers who had a hand up who wanted to share? Any female callers? Right on. Just any other folks, period, who had commentary they wanted to make sure they got in.
I'm holding for workplace racism. Oh, sorry.
Oh, okay, right on. Okay. Bay Area mom waiting for workplace racism. Thomas in New York, if you can hang tight, I just want to make sure I get all the people who we have not heard from. Are there other people on the line who had a hand up? Because I feel like I'm looking at hands. Other folks that we have not heard from who had commentary?
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Just really quickly, I dialed in late. I would like to, Gus, do you keep in contact with Dr. Cambon at all on a regular basis? You know, he's one of my favorite guests on your show, and I'm always interested in his observations and his analysis with racism or whatever. But just wanted to ask, and I did have a few things for workplace racism.
Right on. Let's see. I guess it would depend on what you mean. Regular. He generally will drop KamauKambon.org if people are interested. KamauKambon.org. Visit the website. More information. He will drop me an email ever so often with information he wants me to check out, potential guests, news program that he thinks is noteworthy. He'll do that. I try to give him a call about every other month or so. We had been exchanging emails when Dr. Welsing passed earlier this year, and I told him I wanted to kind of call and get his thoughts, maybe even something we could share on the program, similar to what he did for us with Dr. Ben last year when he transitioned. But I just haven't made the time to call him to get that done, to get his thoughts on her passing and anything else. But I do try to give him a ring about every other month or so. Sometimes there's a bit longer period before I'm able to call him. But emails, and he'll drop me an email from time to time, as I said, with different information and what have you also.
Okay, so I guess I should have been more specific with my question. So no plans in the near future for him to be on the program?
No plans for that. However, I do need to call him because we had talked about this, getting him to come share his thoughts about Dr. Welsing's transition. So that is something that I want to call him and see if we can make that happen.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Other folks that are on the line that we have not heard from, do you all have commentary you want to make sure you got in? All righty, making sure we haven't missed anybody. Anybody that we have not heard from, do you have comments you want to make sure you got in? I'll assume they are waiting for workplace racism or whatever else it is. Let me see. I think, Raj, you were going to respond to the comment about encouraging sympathy with other victims of racism, and then I heard Thomas in New York as well.
Yes.
Can I say this before I receive a response? Because I just wanted to add something else. She believed that, you know, I was born, this is what she would say to me, you know, I was born knowing. I knew from a young child that I understood certain things and I expect better behavior from black people, from victims, and we should treat each other better. And her stance, her strong stance is really that, well, I've always known from a young child that you have to behave a certain way and you should behave better toward your own people. And that she doesn't, whenever she sees black people, although she understands that we are under this system to a degree, she always feels like, you know, well, I know how to cry on white people's shoulder. When I need something, I know how to cry on white people's shoulder. And she just feels like she was born knowing. So how do you address that when you do use your own personal examples from your own life and understanding that you are, too, a work in progress and we are all victims of this system? So I don't know if that's going to change how people are going to respond, but I just wanted to add that in as well. Sorry about that. I apologize for the interruption.
Oh, no apologies necessary. It's fine. It just brings a more holistic understanding of the situation that you're dealing with. What I tend to do and with people, period, and it tends to have a pretty good effect on their understanding, is I literally just explain all 10 areas of people activity, and I speak to the fact that in slavery, we had no control over any of those things. Essentially, white people were our God. We had to do anything they wanted, and we had no control. And then I explained that that situation is exactly the same today. I said, if then I always tell them, if you think of the same 10 areas of people activity, do black people control any of them? They answer no every time. And most times they say, I never thought about it that way. But you're absolutely right. And from there, essentially, I used Dr. Welsing's analogy of the pillar of white supremacy, with the roof being white supremacy itself, and the left pillar would be white fear of genetic annihilation. The right pillar would be anti-blackness or non-white people fighting with one another. And I also speak to the fact that white people are less than 10% of the world's population, but they control the other 90% of the world's non-white people, as well as more than 90% of the world's resources. And the only way they could maintain that kind of domination is with psychological control over the 90%. And what she would be bearing witness to is that psychological control in a self-perpetuating state. Also, I use another analogy of a white person walking a dog. You're walking down the street, they're walking the dog, and the dog attacks you and it bites you. But you're not looking at the person holding the leash, you're blaming the dog. And basically every black person has that little, what we call the white chip on this program, which I would just say is that invisible white person, that white supremacist, holding the psychological leash on the person who is quote-unquote misbehaving or mistreating another non-white person. And I find that those visual aids tend to help their understanding. And I have never gotten a negative response to that. Sometimes they'll have a different perception of things just because they do. And VGQ, that's no problem. But ultimately, when I speak in those terms, it tends to have a more profound effect on the understanding of the system of white supremacy and the role it plays in psychologically controlling the behavior of non-white people in ways that they're not even consciously aware of. I hope that helps. And thank you for listening to my answer.
Were you, Thomas in New York, were you going to respond to the question? She was soliciting suggestions in terms of how you encourage, develop empathy with other black people?
Yeah, I was. I was really going to make a comment about something else.
Oh, okay.
But what the lady did say was that the friend gets you. So, I mean, I would just cherish the fact that my friend got it, because my level of friends have gone. Since, I mean, this is all I talk about. And, you know, a lot of people don't want to talk about this. So, you know, it's going from a lot to a few. So I would say, as long as you have a friend that gets it, if they want to show a little anti-blackness and talk about it, I mean, hey, I'll just accept that. I mean, and maybe let them listen to the cows. Maybe they'll get a little bit of codification. But I would just, hey, take it for what it's worth. Because not too many people get it. What I was going to say is that the church thing, let's not forget that majority of black people are Christian, and they go to church every week looking and praying to a white savior. And here comes your savior. The politician is usually that person. So they always use the church as a way to get to black people because they know we have a white savior complex. And that's all I wanted to say about that.
Hang on. I'm checking to see if other people have commentary that they want to get in. I did hear some metaphors, and that's one of the reasons I encourage people to pay attention to the metaphors that are given out when people are describing racism, white supremacy. I think frequently if someone used a metaphor and black people were described as the dog in the metaphor, if I heard that correctly, people might have a question or some concern about that. I think we had a white guest on the program earlier this year where he was using metaphors where black people were the dog in the metaphor. That's why I say just make sure we're paying attention and being mindful when metaphors get employed to explain racism, white supremacy. Did anybody else have responses they wanted to give to the suggestions that, oh, wait a minute. Do we have anybody that has not shared at all that wanted to get in? Just making sure I haven't missed anyone. All right, I assume we're good. Anybody wanted to respond to the suggestion in terms of how we encourage sympathy from other victims of racism?
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, well, what has been helpful for me is to try to be more objective instead of acting off emotion, especially being a female. And so just trying to be a little more understanding as well because, I mean, there's a lot that we're going through and we're bombarded constantly with all these images of white women and, you know, that whole white chip or metaphor, that whole and level of anti-blackness and just, like I said, being bombarded with all this whiteness constantly, it definitely plays on our psyche, especially on a subconscious level. So just be patient. I mean, that's definitely been more helpful with me because, like the other caller mentioned, the guy, he was saying that his friends have dwindled, and it's like on the level of, you know, you're just trying to hold on to some people, but you have to be true to yourself as well. And it's hard because, especially talking to other black women, if you mention anything about white women, they come in defense of these white women. It's almost as if, you know, they could care less about their own well-being or their children. Is how dare you say something about this white woman, especially with Hillary Clinton. They feel like, you know, she is, you know, going to be their savior of some sort. But, I mean, that has been sort of helpful. But nonetheless, I mean, it's still a struggle. So, I mean, I don't know if anybody can give me any suggestions because that's something that's been really hard as far as to, you know, bringing up these issues. And, you know, they will just almost curse you out if you say anything about, you know, what these white women are doing. It's almost as if they think that white women do not practice racism. I mean, I homeschool, and it's because of racism, so I'm fully aware of what's going on. But, you know, I guess some people come to it slower than others. But if you guys can give any suggestions about that as well, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
I was just going to chime in on the first request for suggestions. I think that the greatest thing is to show the example by not yourself, by not criticizing another non-white victim in that way. And also use the terminology from Mr. Fuller's victims guaranteed qualifications as an explanation and explain on what that means. Also, anytime I hear of a non-white person under the system of racism, white supremacy, say that they know it all or know, you know, something clearly, that gives me some kind of suspicion that maybe I need to limit my conversation with that person until the issue of racism comes up on their behalf. And from there, you can say a lot of things that are constructive that would actually perhaps be more of an impact within their own thought process. Because it's in my mind, logic would tell me it's impossible for there to be a global system of racist white supremacy and a single non-white black person say that I know it all. It's impossible. And that's all I have to say. What was the other suggestion? The other suggestion request?
Oh, sorry. If anyone had any suggestions as far as when you're communicating with other non-white victims about racism and these issues that are going on, in particular when you're dealing with other non-white victims, women in particular, if you mention anything about white women, they get very defensive. And so how to have a constructive conversation without it escalating, per se.
Okay, well, I would. My first thought comes to my mind is a quote from Dr. Frances Welsing that she stated that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And you probably know something about that yourself. I think I heard you said you homeschool your offspring. So, in that light, when the person brings that subject up to you, it would definitely give you a means that they would be, you would have a willing listener, put it that way, that you can be able to explain on how the global system of racist white supremacy works and the very, very important role that white women play into practicing, into assisting, and or being at the front lines of practicing racism, white supremacy. Until then, you know, people have their defense mechanisms and systems up and thoughts up to whereas, they, and especially another non-white person, where they're willing to, you know, they're not even listening to you. They're just waiting for you to be quiet so they can say something, you know, otherwise. So it's just like what Gus does. He mentions a lot in his prayer at the end to be patient with other non-white people, especially non-white black people. It's very important for us to get ourselves in the mindset of being very patient, even though you think you have some necessary information that can help that person, it's still probably the best strategy to wait for them to bring it up before you share it with them. That's my thought. Thank you.
Thank you.
Definitely agree there. And also, I definitely emphasize in terms of if you're seeing, I make an effort to regularly gauge how receptive the person is. If they're seeming like they might be getting agitated or upset or defensive, that they might not be ready to engage in this right now. I know not everyone takes that approach. Some people, you know, they don't have as much regard for that sort of thing, but it's been my experience that the conversation tends to go much better, meaning the person tends to be much more receptive to the ideas that are presented if they're not being defensive, if they're willing to accept and at least think about it. It doesn't mean that they have to immediately agree with the things that you're saying, but to at least think about it. They're asking questions, and you can tell that they're thinking about it, that they're not, you know, up and angry or defensive or defending white people and that sort of thing. So if I see that the person is not ready to accept some of these things, which many of us are not as a result of the system of white supremacy, then I will not push. I will not try to make them discuss these ideas. I'll wait. I might ask a question or two and just go from there. But as I've said, at least in my experience, just being able to not even accuse that person, but just reflecting on my own experience about things that I did that were silly or just totally illogical when I had more confusion about racism, white supremacy, and then being able to pick out other people as well who said the same thing. I found that that works very well as some of the other suggestions that some of the callers mentioned as well, just explaining what racism is, how it works in all areas of people activity, and how white people are in charge in setting up these situations to begin with because of racism. With that, we will transition to workplace racism. Folks have commentary. I know we had people that seemed like they were right there ready for workplace racism. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. People that dialed in have commentary on workplace racism. Feel free. I guess we'll start with our caller in the Bay Area, since you already said that you had something to share for workplace racism.
Can I be heard? Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, super. Okay, workplace racism. Thank you. So after my client, I have a Berkeley client, that after my client transitioned, I took off of work for 3 weeks so I could regroup. And of course, instantly after he passed, they had work for me to do like the next day. But I said no. And I ended up taking an assignment 3 weeks later. So my hours completely diminished to like maybe 17 hours. And I had two clients in 17 hours. The first client is an what are they calling those people? She identifies as being Italian, and then they have all those other things that they connect to, but she's Italian. And the second client was a Spanish male, 90-year-old war vet, because I had him through his care came through the veterans, so he was a veteran client, and his wife was Irish. So I take these clients on, so I literally tend to him, the Spanish male, I tend to him because he's the client. The Italian lady, I would do her twice a week. I would do the Spanish male 3 days a week. But I noticed that the Italian lady, she has this little snippy attitude. So she'll say stuff to me. You know, I'm very pleasant, so I try to be pleasant and cordial. But I don't smile all the time because we're not taking pictures. But my voice is the same. So she hollered at me one day because, and mind you, this is I'll be the fresh client. So she hollered at me one day just after this. She needed the hall a particular way, and there's nothing in the hall but a rug. So I didn't understand. I was like, well, I cleaned the hall. Well, not when I asked you. And she's just hollering and carrying on, so I just gave her this look. And I was like, oh, okay, no worries. So I had to cook for her. So she didn't like the other lady cooking, but now she knew she likes my cooking. So I'm cooking and stuff, and cooking like I asked you. Cook it like I asked you. She wants me to cook it as if I was in Italy. So I had to figure that out. And so it's okay. Sure. I'll do that. I need you to get the dust off of the windowsill. The dust off the windowsill. Wow. I feel like I'm doing housekeeping. Okay, don't you have grandchildren? So it's, yeah, but they don't, yeah. So get the fingerprints off the window. So what did it for me was when she asked me to call my name. So I guess I need you to get olive oil and put it on a rag
and I need you to go to the door and shine the front door on the outside. So I repeated that. And then I forgot I was on the phone. So I said, oh, so you want me to go outside? So I repeated what I just told you. And she's, yes. So I go outside with the rag, and I get the olive oil, and I go out that front door. And she asked me, doesn't it look much better now? Mm-hmm, sure it does. So then she's talking, and, you know, when you're dealing with Caucasians, sometimes they always want to share a story of how they knew some non-black people that went through stuff. They didn't do anything, but they knew non-black people that went through stuff, and they had empathy for them. Yes, I'm listening. So I two-week noticed her, and I didn't want to deal with that anymore. And, the killer was, she had a chair. She needed me to paint her chair. So she said, well, you can have one of your sons paint my chair. I said, paint your chair? What's wrong with your chair? Well, it doesn't look wood. I need oak paint over it, a dark brown oak paint over it. You can have one of your sons do it. Because, of course, being a black woman, my sons don't have anything to do to commit crime. So you've given them a constructive chore. So I thought, okay. So I ended up taking the chair home, painting it, because I knew I'm going to quit. So I brought it back, and she was just happy, and so of course I quit. But the second client, the Italian and Spanish unit, so I catered to the Spanish male because that's my job, and his Italian wife always had, his Irish wife always had chores for me. So she's like, oh, okay, when you finish with Manuel, I need you to do this. Oh, okay, well, when you finish, that's enough with Manuel, I need you to do this. But he's my client, not her. So she said, okay, we're going to go do laundry. We're going to hang the clothes. And you're not going to help me with this basket? Well, how do you normally do laundry? Help me with the basket. What do you do when I'm not here? And I said, I'll help you. We can hold it together. Girl, just give me this basket. We don't need to hold it. Get this basket. So I take the basket. Now I'm hanging clothes. And so she has these undies. They're her undies. And she's like, well, you can hang the panties and socks. So I flip through those panties. Got those socks and picked them up, and she's looking for a sock because she's not going to hang the panties. I'm hanging the panties, but I'm not hanging the panties. You're hanging your own panties. So she's, oh, you didn't do that? Oh, okay. So we go to Costco. It's a warehouse store. We go to Costco, and she tells me that, mind you, the man that I take care of is 90 years old. So she's like, oh, man, well, I'm going to push the basket. I said, the 90-year-old man is going to push the Costco cart in Costco? Yeah, he likes pushing the basket. So, of course, he's 90 years old, so he's slow. Come on, Manuel. Come on, so when he sees Spanish people, he's very excited. So he's like, ¿Cómo está? You know, whatever he's saying. And he's so excited to see someone like him. So she walked to him and said, you don't have to speak to everybody. You just, every time you see Spanish people, you're just speaking to them. You don't have to speak to everybody. And so now the Spanish people are looking like, who's this? And they're looking at her, so every time we go down each aisle, the Spanish people are just looking at her with this stern look. So when we get to the house thereafter, she asked me to dust the plants. I said, she's like, oh, so you don't have anything to do? No, I have something to do. Well, you could go dust the plants. Dust the plants? What plants? And she said, the plants. I said, oh, who dusts plants? What plants? And then I have this oil you can spray on them. So I had to quit because I don't understand that kind of work. I'm a home health aide. I'm not Dana's housekeeping. So I ended up quitting but it taught me something, that no matter who it is, Caucasians or people that identify as being white, whichever part of the world they want to connect with, they always treat us as servants. So I told the company to take me off the schedule, and I haven't been back. And I'm helping my black friend with her mobile nail salon, so I'll see what happens with that. And, yeah, I took an economic hit, but I'll be okay. I don't have to deal with that kind of abuse just to – no. So that's my workplace racism, and thank you for listening.
Wow. Black self-respect on display. Black self-respect on display. That great summary at the end, though, in terms of individuals who classify themselves as white worldwide, how they see black people. We are the help. regardless of what your occupation is, what your level of education is, or what your actual assignment is here. Get a shovel and come dust the plants and all this other just you're supposed to be a slave, basically. Come here and, you know, any other nonsense that you're not even supposed to be doing, you're a Negro. You do whatever I tell you to do. That's your role worldwide as a black person, system of white supremacy. I think having a code in terms of how you're going to deal when she's doing the yelling and other tacky behavior, I think that's important, too, because we've been talking about that this week. I think that comes up almost every time that we do workplace racism, when white people are yelling or coming at you practicing racism, how you respond so that you are not surprised, so you do not have an emotional response. You already have your code in terms of being disciplined and how you're going to respond. I think that's outstanding as well in terms of just minimal response. And then if, you know, you determine, hey, this is not even something that I'm willing to invest any further time and energy, regardless of the paycheck, I'm going to go ahead and take myself off the schedule and discontinue working in this environment. Outstanding for people who have the flexibility and ability to make that happen. Folks had questions that they wanted to ask our mom in the Bay Area, feel free. If no questions or observations about what we heard thus far, if you have your own issues or triumphs, even workplace racism, feel free to share.
May I be heard?
If you could give us a little more volume, please.
May I be heard? Is that better?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I was the one that asked the first question, so I would like to thank everyone for their input. My story of workplace racism is I had actually called in last week, but I'm going to tell a different story. I work at a medical school/hospital in Brooklyn, New York, and we have a cafeteria in the school/medical center hospital. And I drink tea. I often drink tea. I usually purchase like a cup of hot water from the cafeteria, but that can add up. And so there is an office that one of my colleagues had showed me that usually is open, and they have a water cooler where the hot water output that usually works. It produces really hot water. So I'm accustomed to going into that office and no one being there. So one day I went in. This was about a month ago. One day I had went into the office. There was this white guy there. So he says to me, "Oh, you're here for some hot water?" I said, "Yes." So I said, "I usually get it from the cafeteria." So he says, "Oh, okay. So how often do you drink tea? I said, "Well, I drink it, maybe I'll have a cup twice a day." So he said, "How much does it cost to get it from the cafeteria?" I said, "About 60 cents. So he says, "Okay, so let's do the math on that. So you spend like $1.20 per day, times that by a month." And he said, "Well, by the time you come in here and you get your two cups of water, I'll leave the office door for you open." He was like, "You know, you'll be ready to have enough money to go out to pay for a date with me." And I kind of chuckled it off. I was just like, okay. So he said, "I'm going to just leave the door open. So anytime you want to come in and you want to get hot water, you can come in the office and you get hot water." Exactly. So about a month after this encounter, I work in the president's office. So after a month after this encounter, I was in the office. He comes into the office. Now, he doesn't know that I work in that particular office. And as soon as you enter into the office, you're going to see me because I'm at the front desk. So he asked about a specific meeting. He said, "Oh, well, is the meeting going to be taking place in the president's conference room, which is in the back of the office?" So he's like, "I don't know where this meeting is located. Would you happen to know?" And he was talking to the other assistant. He was asking both of us, but the other assistant answered. And so I asked him, I said, "Oh, are you talking about such and such meeting?" And he mumbles under his breath, "What the hell are you talking about?" So I was like, "Oh, I guess I'm assuming he's upset with me because I don't want to date you. I don't want to date a white man. And if I had to date a white man, God forbid, it wouldn't be you. So he was very upset about that. And I just thought that it was very funny. And I thought it was a great example of not just workplace racism, but racism in general. I guess he probably sees me as a black female, like, oh, what are your options? I'm probably the best option out there, even if I'm this whatever looking white man. How much options do black women have? So it goes back to even what the previous caller was talking about, that people see us as black people. Not only do they see us as perpetual slaves, but they just see us as, you know, what options do you have as black women? We know that black men aren't available, so I'm a white man, and you should just jump at the chance to date me no matter what I look like. So just wanted to share that one.
Awesome. Awesome. Great counter-racist response. I think we had had listeners who had mentioned before they were curious about how frequently that sort of thing, these sexual propositions, veiled though they may be, how often that sort of thing pops up on the job, and thinking that that was probably more prevalent because they felt like they weren't hearing it enough. But glad we got that in. Sounds like you handled things well. And again, even with that, I have said consistently, particularly if you start a new job or if they have any training around sexual harassment, since they got the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill documentary on HBO. It premiered within the last 24 hours or so, or this weekend. Confirmation, I think it's called. They have anything like that on your job? Ask those sort of questions in terms of, you know, how should we respond? What's the procedure? Just even if you just asking the question, I think that in and of itself alerts the racists that are present, and even non-white people who might be present, that you are serious. I am not here for people to talk to me any kind of way. I have black self-respect, and I want to know up front, you know, this is what to do. This is the procedure. If people are making those type of remarks or touching or hugging, anything like that, this is the procedure. This is what to do. These are the people to talk to. I always encourage, I think that's great, particularly when you're starting a job, so that you can make that clear from the beginning in terms of what is going to be acceptable in terms of how you are treated. But sounds like you did a great job in navigating that situation. And what I've said, too, about whites, how they are constantly watching him, even monitoring you coming in to get your water and scheming and plotting around this. Just the tackiness abounds. If folks had comments or questions they wanted to ask for the female caller who just shared, thank you for getting that. And if you had comments or questions about what you just heard from her, or if you had your own incidents of workplace racism you wanted to share.
Hey, I had a quick comment because I think that that would have been a prime time for, especially with a female having so much power inside of the workplace, just to make a comment like, you know, you're making me feel very uncomfortable, you know, just putting that in his ear from the back. Like, I'm quite sure his response to that would have been, oh, you know, I don't want you to, because, you know, no one wants to get in that type of trouble. So, you know, just like what you just said, Justin. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I wonder if, how they would respond if a black female was to say, well, I don't date white men. I wonder how that would have played out.
Yeah, usually my response to him when I see him is if I'm walking through the hall and I happen to see him, I just kind of turn the other way. I just ignore him. So I don't speak to him. The only time I speak to him is when I entered into his office, and I had not been back into his office. Once he made that proposition to me, I had not been back into his office. I just go and I pay for my hot water. Or I actually have found someplace else where I can get my hot water whenever I want my tea. But he has come into the office before, prior to him making that remark under his breath. He has come into the office, and usually what I do is I let the other assistant handle him. I don't really communicate with him. Usually what I would do is if I have to go to the copy machine or if I have to go to the restroom, or if I'm working at my computer, I just turn around and I continue to work at my computer. But I really don't I'm not going to say I don't acknowledge him because I acknowledge everybody that comes into the office, but I really try to not have any conversation with him, and I let someone else handle the situation.
Yeah, you see, what I'm saying is, like, a woman has so much power in the workplace. I just can't imagine a white female working, me working with a white female, and she feels uncomfortable enough to have someone else deal with me every time I come into the office. Like, I mean, I think they would nip it in the bud. Like, they'll go right to HR. Listen, every time this guy comes around, I creep you out. And one day I ask you out for a date. I've been seeing this. He's been acting real strange. I mean, I think that sometimes, you know, we might need to go the extra mile like they do.
I think white women, they have a lot of power in the workplace. I totally agree. Although these are just adding white women to be able, and I've seen that myself, where anything like that, man, they can get the president, the CEO, vice president, or whomever else is in charge of that company to come in and stop that immediately. If that means somebody needs to be fired or written up or, you know, whatever sanctions are going to take place, they can get all that going immediately. I'm not sure if non-white, particularly black females, I don't know if they would have that same type of power. In fact, I would say that they probably do not have that same sort of power in the workplace setting. But still, I think at least in terms of what you said earlier about at least saying, I don't feel comfortable with that sort of remark in the workplace, I suspect that that might work to minimize those sort of comments. Certainly, you know your workplace environment better, but I would encourage everyone just on self-respect. I think that is a good route to go. I think that can be a quality suggestion in terms of just making that comment to let it know, hey, that we are in a workplace environment. I'm not comfortable with those sort of comments. I'm not into any sort of dating, fraternizing in that sort of way with colleagues, coworkers, just to make that very clear, very explicit the first time that it comes up, just so that it doesn't happen again. It's been my experience that white people tend to make comments. They chat about us frequently. Wow, she said, you know, I made some sort of overture or what have you, and she said that she didn't feel comfortable and blah, 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 and all this other thing. I know some people might be concerned about losing your job, but I would just encourage that sentence that Thomas said about I do not feel comfortable in the workplace with those sort of remarks.
I wanted to say that situation, I think Gus, you've talked about this, and a couple other non-white visitors to the cows have talked about this. Because of the sexual dynamic between white and black people from the time we've encountered them, white people have this thing where they feel that they have ownership over black bodies and they can do what they want when they want. And that, to me, was kind of a prime example of that. And a couple of visitors to the cows always talk about the fact that when you see any black person, male or female, in a relationship with a white person, it is the white person that does the choosing. And it seems that he was upset because he did the choosing and he did not get chosen in return. And under quote-unquote normal circumstances in the system of white supremacy, he would be a prime catch regardless of what he looks like simply because he's white. So that was so offensive to him that he would take that opportunity to be so disrespectful to her when she was trying to assist him with finding the meeting. So I just wanted to chime in with that because it just reminds me of a couple of episodes I've listened to in the archives where those sorts of things were discussed, and this seems to be a prime example of that within the workplace. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody, I guess anybody, but I was particularly thinking of black females. Anybody here, do you think if you said that in a workplace, like if a white man made some sort of comment like that to you, suggesting, you know, let's go out for a date or whatever, something where it was clear that they were trying to ask you out, and you said, hey, I don't feel comfortable with that sort of thing in the workplace, does anybody feel like their job would be in jeopardy?
Yes, I do. I feel like if you, because that's kind of a slap in their face, because like it's been stated on the program before, white men have a particular, they feel that they own the black woman. And then, too, they figure that our self-esteem is so low because they always make us out to be all these negative things. And since we're no other race actually shows a lot of interest in us except for the black man, when they come at us, we should jump for it. So if I go in and say, well, I felt uncomfortable because Steven, he just kind of approached me sexually, and I didn't understand. They're going to talk amongst each other, and then Steven's going to turn it around, and then I'm going to have to be very careful on my P's and Q's because right now I'm at risk for losing my job because I just made him out to be some sexual predator.
Logical, logical. Anybody else? You feel like you... Go ahead, go ahead.
I apologize. Well, right now, my current status, I'm not even like a permanent employee. I have a temp status that kind of makes everything little, I don't know. So as far as that guy was concerned, I just knew that the best way for me to address it is to never go back into that office because even if I say that I feel uncomfortable going back into the office, it's going to make me think. And I also thought, too, I know that I don't have much interaction with this person. I'm not going to see this person often, so that is what I didn't decide to proceed with going into finding out what the sexual harassment, whatever information they have on sexual harassment, because I just thought about my status as a temp employee, and I just knew that I wasn't going to have any interactions with this man.
Very logical, very logical. Yeah, and that's black females, not white females on the whole, but you do not have the same sort of power as a white woman in the workplace. I'm even remember the situation with Nafisatu Diallo a few years back, Dominic Strauss-Kahn. Folks remember, I don't think that situation would have gone down the same at all if she had been a white female, even in her position as a member of the custodial staff at the hotel where all that happened at. In New York, so that's certainly a valid concern. That's why I said you know your workplace situation better than anybody else in terms of the best way to try to handle these situations. And even if you don't go to human resources, that sort of thing, just letting the person who makes that sort of comment, they're making some sort of sexual overture or what have you, just telling them that you don't feel comfortable with that sort of remark, but I can certainly see how it could go the same route where they end up going to tell somebody and, you know, she tried taking lying and saying that you accused them of being a rapist or something like that and taking accusing you of things that you didn't say. I could certainly see how that could play out as well.
Well, I mean, every job that I've ever started, you have a signed paperwork that it tells you the conduct of that company and what you can and can't say, and that's usually nothing. Nothing of the sexual gesture, not asking no one out, not sending you a printy today, none of that is acceptable for a male in the workplace, and they had to sign paperwork when they took that job. Every job that's a legal job, some of them even make you watch a video showing you all the things that would be a part of the misconduct for men to do to a female. And I mean, I know race always plays into it, but I would think if they didn't follow the rules that they put out there, then you would definitely have a lawsuit as well. Even though you are a temp now, I just started a temp job, and on Wednesday I started the job, and I had to sign 3 papers about sexual misconduct that's not acceptable for the company I'm in. And I just wondered, did you have to start filling these paperwork out when you started that job that dealt with sexual harassment? Because I think that you definitely would have a valid case. I'm not saying you should do it. Just saying.
Well, I really appreciate all of the comments and suggestions, and I will have to take a look at the paperwork as far as any policies that they have regarding that. So I appreciate all of the suggestions. Thank you.
For sure. I've had to do that for a lot of jobs as well, where they have seminars and workshops. Sometimes they'll do it at the beginning of the job, and then they'll make you do it again at some time on the job. If you've been there a year or 5 years or whatever the case, they'll make everybody come in and get what they call a refresher course on sexual harassment and appropriate comments in the workplace or inappropriate comments. And then this is what you're supposed to do in terms of this is the protocol for how we handle these sort of things on the job. If somebody's saying something to you that you don't feel comfortable in and that sort of thing. But again, as I said before, I seriously doubt that a black person, a black female is going to have the same sort of protections under the system of white supremacy. That's why I say certainly you know your workplace environment better in terms of the best way to handle that sort of thing. That's not going to make more problems for you. I was also thinking in the middle of all this, too, that you could just say, I don't date employees. I don't date people that I work with. Just leave it at that. I think that one might also get you out of that sort of situation without it being something that becomes a greater problem. That's just quick, flat, doesn't bring up race at all. I don't date colleagues. I don't date people that I work with, and keep going about your business.
I had a quick question for the caller as well. Did you actually write down the incident as far as the detail? Because he was practicing racism even in his approach by saying you can save your $1.20 a day, you know, until you save up your nickels to come and take me out on a date. Like, that was crazy. I just wanted to know if you wrote that down and, like you have a record of it. So in case anything does pop up, you have the time and date of the incident and everything, and you can relay the details. And then that subsequent contact where he was so rude and disrespectful to you, like, any contact that you've had to have with him where it has been inappropriate or could be potentially interpreted as inappropriate based on the context of that initial attempt to take you out on a date. Thank you.
You know what? I listen to the cows all the time, and I know there's a suggestion to write down these things, and I have been a little lax with it, so my response to that would be no. I did not write down either one of these comments. Or situations. I didn't write down the comment, and I did not write down the first situation.
Just a suggestion. I don't know if there was anything significant that might have happened on the job on either of those given days, but if there was anything significant that might have come down in email where you remember, hey, I got this email regarding this particular thing, try and go back to that, whatever associated email or whatever associated event on the job, and it should give you a time frame for the date that that happened, and then you can, I guess, kind of make an educated guess for the time frame, but you definitely want to record it, just because his approach was just ridiculously white supremacist and just so tacky, trifling, and terroristic to tell someone save your $1.20 because you spend 60 cents a day on hot water, 60 cents purchase on hot water to save up your nickels to take his sorry behind, his trashy reptilian behind out on a date. So I just, if there's any significant event that took place on that day where you can maybe track it in via email or something, it'll give you the date that it happened and then just kind of juxtapose that with an estimated educated guess on the time frame that it happened. That might help, but I definitely would say record those situations if you can. Even now, just record it anyway. And even if you're not able to get the exact date, just approximate it, but just record it as much as you can remember. If there's anything significant you can associate with that day, you might be able to backtrack to get the exact date and then just do an estimated guess on the time. Thank you.
Once again, thank you. And actually, for the second event where he mumbled underneath his breath, what the hell are you talking about? That one would be a lot easier for me to track down the date and time because, as you mentioned, something significant happened. He asked about a specific meeting, and I have a calendar where it's been jotted down that that particular meeting happened and around the time. So that I can definitely easily identify. The first incident where he had mentioned about saving up my coins to take him on a date, that one is going to be a little bit more difficult because it happened over a month ago.
Maybe you might have a receipt for when you first started buying water again. So maybe check your purse if you might have kept an old date of receipt. You might have had a receipt because I remember you said that's when you started going back to either buying coffee or whatever. Something like that. It might help you track down the date or just even estimate that time. Make an educated guess on that. But write down as much detail as possible because it might come in handy in case they try to do something slick to you moving down the line, moving down the road. Thank you.
Hey, my last thing is, man, that was such a great idea, right, Jaron? And probably you because it's already happened, but for other people who listen and it didn't happen to them yet, when it does, you know, write it down and tell one of your coworkers that you're cool with what happened and put that in the report too. So you also have a witness trail, also with that paper trail. You know, when it comes down to an investigation, or let's just say they let you go one day. I mean, that's, and I've been getting harassed. And this date, look, I got a whole log. I got, well, you got all these witnesses' names in those reports. They're gonna go back and they're gonna confirm. Yeah, she did say that happened to her. And I mean, that could help a woman out definitely on the workforce.
Lady, did you have comments you were going to get in?
Yes, may I be heard?
If you could give us a bit more volume, that would be helpful.
Okay, I hope that's better. Sorry I chimed in late. I was not going to make a comment. I just was going to listen in, but I heard the caller's story, and just wanting to say we have no power in regards to that. I'm not giving a suggestion to the call or anything like that, but I had an incident a few years back on a job where the harassment from this white male who was about 20 years older than me had gotten so bad to where he had showed me his genitalia just right there on the job. I reported it. I wrote my little email. Before we even got to the email stage, white woman is the boss, and became very angry and upset with me when I brought this up. She told me, I don't believe it. I believe you had something going on with him. I believe you have been initiating something with this white male. Right off the bat, they didn't even finish going over the months of harassment from this male and how over the top he had become, especially when he found out I was with child on the job. He just went after me even more. So I did that. I went on my maternity leave right before I went, and then I submitted this paperwork. This male was given a raise and given full-time status before I could come back on my 6 weeks. I had heard about some jobs were going to be cut. Of course, my job was the one that was cut. I was laid off and let go of. So there was no protection from the job. There was, you know, it was very nasty, and I had no power. So I think that only applies to white women, and the white women came to fire me. So that pretty much was the comment that I wanted to make about that.
I'm so sorry. Really sorry to hear about that. My God. Wow. And I appreciate you sharing your story.
For sure. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. Yeah, that's about what I thought. It would be white women who would have those sort of protection. I'm not surprised that the white women, it was last night they had my BFF forever, Amy Goodman. She was on Bill Maher's show, my two favorite whites in the whole entire universe. And they were talking about the documentary on Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas. And they were saying that they think things would be so much, because this happened in the 90s. And they were saying that they think things would be different now, because when the hearings took place, I think there were only like two, I'm forgetting the number, I think it was like two, less than five female senators who were present and participating in the hearings. And they said they're like 20 now, so they think it would be different. And if it was like 50, if it was half, since there are 100, if it was half female senators, that it would be way better, and there would have been way more support for Anita Hill. And the crowd went wild. And I was like, I don't think that is the case, because I've seen no evidence that white women are that supportive of black females when these sort of things happen. The Daniel Holtzclaw trial, that might be one illustration. I did not see white women rallying to support those victims in Oklahoma. But yeah, I'm super glad we got that in. And that's why I said I totally recognize it's totally logical to have that sort of concern, that if you say, hey, I'm not comfortable with that sort of thing in the workplace, white people might not believe you, and they might even come to fire you, as what lady said happened, even though it might have been a little bit of time. It wasn't an immediate thing, but within the next 2-3 weeks up, we no longer need for your services. Here's your resignation slip, and, you know, peace out. I totally could understand that sort of thing happening. That's why I said you kind of got to make the best decision about what you're willing to tolerate, what you can do financially. It's a terrible predicament that they have us in, and just trying to make the best decisions to deal with things.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I think the last female caller was very, very accurate. Based on, of course, I'm not a black female, but from being on a job for 27 and a half years and observing, and also from logic standpoint, I can see where what she was saying is accurate as far as HR and all the rest of that. It's almost null and void on what could take place as far as something positive on the black female's side. I do have a story. I don't recommend that it is to be repeated, but a friend of mine who also is a firefighter, his wife was an enforcement official. She's retired. She's been retired since. But back early in her career as a school enforcement official, she had a harassment episode. And what her husband did, who was very, very close, he had us to show up with him on her lunch break. And we walked into the police office. It was about somewhere around 8 to 10 of us. And you have to imagine the picture that I'm trying to paint. I just made a metaphor. Sorry about that. It was about 8 to 10 athletic-looking black males that went into this police station in the lobby area, and basically wasn't saying anything, just standing around in there while he was with his wife during that lunch break. And ironically, she didn't have any more harassment problems out of whoever that white male employee was at the time. She ended up retiring on the administrative staff, some like a rank of captain or something like that from the school police. But as I mentioned, I wouldn't recommend anybody to do something like that. But nevertheless, I'm in agreement with the last female caller.
Right on. We did our three. We will be here tomorrow morning for the early broadcast, 12 noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, Global Sunday Talk on Racism. Folks chiming in from around the world to share their thoughts on racism, but definitely be interested in picking the discussion up in terms of just strategies, because I think that's important in terms for best strategies in terms for dealing with sexual harassment in the workplace, because I think that's super important. I'm sure there's tons of people that are dealing with that sort of thing, even if it doesn't get as horrendous as what Lady described, the last female caller, where they're actually showing genitalia in the workplace. Just the comments and those sort of things having to be
muted.
That.
Unmuted.
Just where it gets to that point where you have to deal with, excuse me, those sort of comments and asking you out, just any unnecessary commentary that you have to deal with in the workplace to get more strategies on how to successfully neutralize that without creating extra problems. That's kind of the other thing to keep in mind, where you can successfully deal with that situation and then it doesn't become something where whites use that to then attack you and find out a way to mess you up on your job or change your schedule around or just create new problems for you as a result of trying to deal with that. There should be some strategies out that are more helpful, but definitely make sure you're not thinking that you're going to have the same protection as a white woman on the job, because you are not. Regardless of who you are, workplace situation, black females, black males, whomever, you're just not going to have the same sort of protection, security. You're not going to have the cavalry coming to save you on the job situation when you have those sort of things to deal with. So be good to get some strategies to help out. Thanks for all the folks for sharing, participating, suggestions, commentary. Super, super helpful, super informative. And I'm sure it's helpful for people listening in who maybe have not dealt with that sort of thing, just to kind of know the type of things, unfortunately, that you might have to deal with so that you're not surprised. I think that's one of the most important things, too, not being stunned when these type of things happen, because I think a lot of times that, too, can get us in a situation where we just don't expect it. We're surprised and we're thinking that this is not a system of racism, that this is Bob, this is Ted, that these folks are cool, they're nice, they're not going to do anything to us. And then they come in and turn the terrorism on, and we're befuddled about what to do, how to respond. I think just knowing, yeah, this is the environment that we're in, then, you know, just be prepared on a regular basis, even if you've been on the job for a long period of time and there has been no significant misbehavior directed at you, still, you should be alert, be prepared, because this is the system that we're in. With that, again, we'll be here tomorrow, 12 noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. Global Sunday Talk on Racism. Looking forward to hearing from some of our listeners in different parts of the world to get their views on what's been transpiring globally. Racism, white supremacy. Chime in if you are able early on your Sunday. We also should be here Monday. We should have attempted counter-racist parents giving some information on how their parenting styles have changed as they have gotten more information about racism, how things changed from when they were more confused and how they dealt with their children then, and then as they got more information about racism, how it impacted the way that they relate to their children, positive and negative. It's not necessarily all wonderful once you get information about racism, and I think that's important for folks who have black children and are trying the best they can to share this information with their offspring. That being said, we will wrap up. I will again encourage sobriety. Has sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. You do not want to make racist job easier by being under the influence, particularly if you're out and about, if you're in a vehicle, driver, passenger, even a pedestrian. You do not want to make Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, you don't want to make their job easier by being intoxicated. You want to be able to make the best possible decisions when you are lucid, clear thinking, to keep yourself as safe as possible, you and any folks that you might be responsible for when you're out and about. Buckle up. Let's try to do everything that we can to minimize contact with enforcement officers. With that, Creator, it has been time. Help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. Help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.